Tonight on The Download, longtime political activist Marilyn Katz, Wild Bow President Jeff Alexander, and from HBO's Veep, Dan Bacadal. And now, here's your host, a man who was called the nuclear option back in his college days, Justin Kaufman.
You needed a party cleared? You needed a room cleared? Got to go to the nuclear option. Bring in Kaufman. Come in with a little clown routine. And everyone's gone. Everyone goes home. Hey, it's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Great to be with you tonight. Thank you for letting me ride shotgun on your rainy evening. Sorry we didn't get the White Sox game in tonight, but we will get it in tomorrow, right? It's exciting. I mean, it gets you somewhat angry that they try to play these games beginning of April, but we understand you have to do it. So the Sox will be back on the field for the beginning of the historic season in which they win the World Championship. I'm just throwing stuff out. Like I said, I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight here on WGN Radio. We have got a tremendous show lined up for you once again. I'm so excited about tonight's show. Just doing the prep and getting ready for the show. There's so many interesting people that are on the show. Coming up in the 7:30 hour, Dave Lundy and Chris Veronis, who will be in for Chris Roebling, will be in studio. Touche, it's Monday. A lot to talk about. Nuclear option, unmasking, Blackwater, right there. That's all. Every week it's the same thing, just a different name. Chris and Dave in studio. We will talk about the latest in national politics, as we do every Monday here on The Download. Coming up at 8 o'clock, Marilyn Katz is going to join us. She is the longtime political activist, writer, PR woman. She has her own company, MK Communications. But Marilyn Katz has spent half of a century in Chicago politics in general, whether it be the march with Reverend King back in, 1966, Marquette Park. She was in that march to just being an organizer of the Women's March after the inauguration here in Chicago. Marilyn Katz has been a voice in Chicago politics. She's worked for three different mayors, and she continues to sort of lead by policy. She's a very active member of Chicago's progressive political community, trying to make sure that neighborhoods are represented, that neighborhoods are not left behind by downtown renovation and economic redevelopment. So we'll talk with Marilyn Katz coming up at 8 o'clock about her history, her career, about movements and marches, momentum as well. 9 o'clock. Hey, you know what? Let's talk about the future of fast food. I'm really liking the name of our new segment. We call it Industry Night. On Monday nights, that's where we're going to put chefs. And we put the culinary arts, things about, restaurants and beer. And last week, I think we talked about beer with the guys from Goose Island. Tonight, very excited to have the president of Wild Bow. Wild Bow, the Let Us Entertain You giant, serving up steam buns since 2004. Talk to them about the future of fast food. You know, the Bow is really sort of known as a street food, a very fast sort of cart-driven street food in Hong Kong. And they brought it here, 12, 13 years ago, Let Us Entertain You did, to sort of replicate that. And it really is, in all sense of the word, fast food. The food is boom, boom, boom. They serve customers out the wazoo per hour. They are rethinking and sort of energizing fast food as we know it here in the States and in the city of Chicago. We'll talk to them about what their plans are for the future. Also tonight, Eddie Furman and Dan Bacadal in studio. The group Trainwreck, known to the improv community. Dan Bacadal, of course, one of the stars of Veep, also in the show Life in Pieces on CBS. Dan Bacadal was a Second City main stage guy. So was Eddie Furman. So they come together. They do a two-person improv show. They're doing it at Second City ETC tomorrow night and Wednesday night. But they will be in studio tonight to talk about the craft. And coming up, very excited, the Flesh Panthers in Studio 435, live music, indie rock. I'm excited. All right, news, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back and do the carryout. Stay with us. This is The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, let's get this show on the road. We'll start with the carryout. Of course, nightly segment where I read the news to you at home. You don't have to. All right, here are today's top stories. It's the end of the Senate as we know it. I feel fine. Leonard Bernstein. That's all I remember from the song. We're either heading to an all-night Senate jamboree or we're heading to an unprecedented political rule changing for the Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. Question, will the jamboree have live music, like a banjo? Republicans don't have the 60 votes to secure the nomination for Gorsuch, so instead of that just being the rule, the lawmakers just changed the rule. The nuclear option makes it a simple majority. Now, to be fair to Republicans, this is a Democrat idea, but to be fair to all of us, stop! Do your job! So we learn nothing from the Trump campaign. People don't vote for you to entrench. They vote for you guys to work together or to just bypass you in general. This precedent is dangerous because from here on out, any Supreme Court justice can be nominated by one-party rule. Before, at least, you had to convince some from the other party to come over. See Roberts or Kagan or Sotomayor. That way you don't put hardline judges on the Supreme Court. In other words, everybody's unhappy. Like it's supposed to be. Also, it's called the nuclear option. That's a dumb thing to call something that's being used for the Supreme Court. How about you do a simple majority vote on changing the name from nuclear option to simple majority, right? Can we just do that? I think we're not dumb. We get the concept of simple majority. And really, are we filibustering a Supreme Court justice now? First Democrat to get cute to read Dr. Seuss or tell us about what they had for breakfast, I am running a primary against. Personally, I'll run against all y'all. Try it, stop me. Former National Security Advisor Susan Rice is being accused of trying to unmask Trump transition team members during said transition. I haven't paid too much attention, but unmasking is either A, when you try to identify Americans caught in intelligence, or B, when you and your friends and their loyal dog rip off the monster's head to reveal it was a wealthy billionaire the whole time. I think both situations apply here. Mylan, the company that makes the EpiPen, remember the company that makes the EpiPen that jacked up the price to $600 an injection last year? Well, they're recalling the EpiPens. I guess in a couple situations, the auto-inject failed. So I present to you this info without snark. You jack up the price of a life-saving allergy medicine, and it doesn't work. Are we good here? I think we're good. Nothing to see? Okay, no jokes needed. Today starts street sweeping in the city of Chicago, also known as the time of the year when we wake up in a cold sweat trying to remember if the sign tied to the tree had a T or an F on it. Oh. A new study says that 1 in 4 car accidents have the driver using a phone before the crash, distracted driving, texting. Ugh. See, this is why I say distracted driving is bad. This is why you don't change a channel. Too much button pushing. Just keep it right here, 720 WGN. For your safety. Also, text your friends. Tell them to listen. Yeah. We'll do it now. We'll wait. Panera's stock soared today. Ooh, a new spring shrimp salad? Maybe an Asiago roast beef and cheddar? A new breakfast souffle? Oh, no, it's because there are rumors that the company's being put up for sale. Nothing like a for sale sign to drive up the price of your company. And here I thought it was a chips or apples option. Just thought that was a great... Oh. I'll buy stock in this company. They give you chips or an apple. In weather, April showers right on cue. Great. In sports, where do we start? Huh? The Cubs lost in the bottom of the ninth inning last night. But let's face it, they returned for opening day. The same team and spirit that won the World Series. As a baseball fan, what a game to watch. Amazing way to start the season. And their curse is now that every team they play is going to want a piece of that feeling. Right? 162 games of playoff atmosphere. You ready? All right, really like 110 because there's going to be plenty of phone-ins. In July, when the Diamondbacks come to Wrigley, not as playoff atmosphere as you'd like. But still, also the Cubs, the first to use the no-pitch intentional walk. I mean, come on, they're so Hollywood. They're even doing that. They're the only team. On the South Side, what a way to start a rebuilding season with a rainout. Remind me again why the baseball schedulers have a Chicago team opening at home in early April. Really, couldn't get the Sox to start in Houston, maybe L.A.? I'll make it up tomorrow at 1:10. The NHL won't stop the season next year and let their players play in the Winter Olympics, which is probably good for the league, you know, to give the players rest. Oh, wait, they're not stopping the season? Oh, so essentially the NHL just wants to make money, so the Olympics can figure out a different way to make their money. Got it. We're all good. Fans are good. Figured it out. The Hawks enter the final week of the year with a sizable lead for the number one overall in the West. It's not clinched, but it's a foregone conclusion. Now, who will they play, Nashville or St. Louis? I mean, does it really matter because the goofy way the Stanley Cups does their playoffs? I mean, we're essentially going to play one of them in the first two rounds. I know it could be the Wild as well, but come on, it's the Wild. They're terrible. The Hawks just need to coast without injury and get ready for the next 3 months of playoff hockey. The Bulls are making a late season run to make the playoffs. They've won four in a row and have somewhat watched everyone around them lose, and they hold the seventh seed, only one game from the sixth, two back from the fifth. Wow, Eastern Conference basketball, huh? If the season ended today, the Bulls would get the Cavs in the first round. If they can move up to six, they get the Raptors. That's crazy. The Bulls match up pretty well against either right now, although it'd be nice to avoid LeBron as long as you could. Any Bears news? Nah. And finally, Australians have confirmed several sightings of the Tasmanian tiger, a species that was supposed to be extinct 80 years ago. Well, what are we waiting for? Go kill it so we can see what its deal is. Come on, scientists, do something for once. That's the carryout for April 3rd, 2017. In honor of opening day, we serve smushed hot dogs, stale popcorn, and $11 licorice ropes. You're welcome. All right, coming up, Dave Lundy and Chris Varonis will be in studio. It's time for Monday's Touche. We'll talk about national politics. What do we got? Ooh, we got a lot. Nuclear option lot. Like that. I mean, that's how much we have. We might even have to use the nuclear option. It's the Download 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
Oh, I'm doing well. How about you?
Good. Good weekend?
Not bad.
Not
Wisconsin
bad.
Dells went to Great Wolf Lodge
what?
With the kids. Yeah, capped off their spring break. Why not? You know.
Are you the kind of dad that sits back and lets them roll, or do you get in there?
I try to get involved, but here's the thing. In the shape that I'm currently in, there's really no graceful way to get in and or out of the tube that you have to carry up five flights of stairs to go down what's called the Howland Tornado.
Yeah, right.
Which really looks like you're just being flushed down a big giant toilet bowl.
I know.
Yeah.
I have the same feeling. When I did that this summer, I was like, ah. Really?
And I got up to the top, and I literally, it is five flights. And Aiden would look at me and go, Dad, why are you breathing so hard? I'm like, because I got to carry this 70-pound tube up five flights of stairs. What do I look like,
Dad, why are you so nervous?
A Marine?
Why are you so nervous? Why are you breathing so heavy and sweating?
But, you know,
it's not a nerve thing, son.
One thing that I did realize is that as bad a shape as I'm in right now, I felt okay when I took my shirt off at Great Wolf
you
Lodge.
You look good. It's hard for me to comprehend the I'm out of shape Rob Martier game because you look good, buddy.
We're a lot of blousy shirts.
I mean, you're a blousy shirt guy, but that's good. You look good.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche. You go right,
you go right, you go. All right, it's Touche. It's Monday night. Lots to talk about. Wow. Dave Lundy, Chris Varonis in for Chris Roebling. Good to see you guys. How are you?
Justin, good to see you, too.
All right, gentlemen, let's get right to it. I mean, we don't limited time. I feel like we could do 4 hours on these topics. And let's start with the Supreme Court nomination. The Democrats have secured enough votes to block a Supreme Court nomination of Neil Gorsuch. Not surprising, but they should be able to push a nomination through with the actual majority there. What does this mean? Let's start there before we even get to the nuclear option.
Well, first of all, I was surprised. I did not think Democrats were going to be able to hold a filibuster majority or a filibuster proof number. I didn't think that because, you know, Gorsuch is ranked as well qualified. And historically, you let people like Alito and Thomas through, and we have in this country. But I think that it's this is just revenge for Merrick Garland. I mean, this is, you know, you denied a guy who was universally qualified, that everybody loved, that had gotten unanimous support. And now here
except
we are.
Except from Chris Varonis.
Revenge. I think this is a Hail Mary pass that no one thought we'd catch. Nobody.
This is the third line, right?
The election. There was a vote. Everyone thought Hillary was going to win.
Yeah. including you and me?
Including you and me.
Yeah.
And so there is no question that Neil Gorsuch will be on the court. The only question is it going to take 51 votes or 60 votes? And you know what? I think some of the best insight to come out of this whole thing comes from Claire McCaskill from Missouri, who said, what if we wind up rejecting Neil Gorsuch and the filibuster goes away? You know, right now you've got Scalia for Scalia. But what happens when you have Scalia for a Ruth Bader Ginsburg,
right,
who gets sick or passes away, yeah, but you're or someone have who that, retires?
But you're gonna have that anyway.
But what you're looking at right now, Dave, is not only losing the battle, but the war. Because
but that's,
you've
that's
got
a great,
three justices who are nearing retirement
but,
age.
But you can make the same argument here by enacting the nuclear option, which seems to be the move for Mitch McConnell, by bringing that in and setting precedent at the Supreme Court level. And let's say that the next president is not of the same party and gets the opportunity, or yeah, let's say that the Senate, yeah, is not of the same party, they're going to use the same thing. I mean, it's a slippery slope in which
you're right.
Scares me. I mean, is it worth sort of as American citizens to start sort of taking words out of Senator McCain's mouth saying this is the end of the Senate?
Well, here's the thing. If the filibuster is hanging by that small of a thread, it's already gone. It's if you could just eliminate it by saying, you know, that's it. We can always go nuclear. Then you have no filibuster.
Well,
Harry Reid
never had a problem.
No.
Rid of it for the federal judges.
No. I mean, Slow down there, big fella. You're distorting history.
I want to know this story. Yeah.
But so, he applied it for federal judges.
No. Yeah, he applied it for federal judges after the Republicans, in a break with historic precedent, refused to allow up or down votes on President Obama's judges and President Obama's appointments and up and down the line. It was unprecedented. There were more filibusters during the Obama years than the previous century, okay, of judicial nominees. What you guys did on the right was unprecedented. And in a move of desperation, Obama said, hey, and Harry Reid said, hey, I'm an institutionalist, but we're going to get no judges at all unless we, and you had vacancies on the court all over the country, and the wheels of justice were grinding to a halt. So they did that, and the risk was, well, if you do that now, then you're setting a precedent. But again, my point is the filibuster for judges is dead. It doesn't matter. If they can execute the nuclear option,
why slow it down, right?
Then what is this? It's all a bunch of song and dance and hooey. I personally, though, am not 100% sure that they're going to be able to do that.
Really?
And because you're going to have there are a lot of Republicans, institutionalists, who don't want to give that away.
You think by giving up the nuclear option or going that route that there would be Republican senators who would say, I don't want to be involved in this because you're ruining precedent, or you're setting a precedent.
You're destroying the
Senate.
It's still politically not a smart move. To do this, to put a filibuster on a guy who's eminently qualified, a Jimmy Stewart with a 150 IQ with jurisprudence.
But Democrats would say that's not the case.
It would be different if you had a weaker candidate.
Yeah,
but Gorsuch is not that.
But why not? What is the political damage you see coming to the Democratic Party? Because I got to tell you, the Republicans just said no for 8 solid years, and they have a House, the Senate, and the White House.
How about a justice who is to the right of Gorsuch coming after Gorsuch with 51 votes approval?
Well, we'll see if they get it.
Well, but you see the point?
Yeah, no, I see the point, but
I think that
Chuck Schumer said it best yesterday, since we're going to quote senators, apparently both quoting Democrats. But Chuck Schumer said it best yesterday. He said, look, if you can't get 60 votes, instead of just throwing away the filibuster,
ridiculous,
get a better candidate.
No, you're a better candidate. Give me a break.
Gorsuch is a right-wing extremist. The man. Are you familiar with some of what he's
Ruth
done to
Bader
human
Ginsburg
rights?
Ruth Bader Ginsburg complimented him. The Solicitor General under Obama wrote an op-ed in the New York Times supporting him. You're wasting fire on a guy who's the Jimmy Stewart. Who's going to be the Jimmy Stewart on the Supreme Court.
Yeah, the Jimmy Stewart with a fascist streak that will destroy individual rights.
I think it just.
No, I'm sorry. Look at what he did to that poor trucker.
Oh, come on.
That poor trucker was
give
insane.
Me a break. Is that the best you could do, Dave? Come on.
No, there's cases galore where Gorsuch has failed to stand up for individual rights.
I could run a semi-truck through your arguments right now.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, go ahead. You are escalating.
Show me where Gorsuch has stood up for individual rights against the corporation.
In about the last 50 years, The only time you had a threat of a filibuster was by the Democrats, and that was with Rehnquist and Alito, and Democrats did that. You have to go back to 1888.
Democrats didn't filibuster Rehnquist and
they
Alito.
They attempted to.
No, they didn't attempt the cloture, to. They didn't do it.
The cloture, yeah, that's because they couldn't get cloture to cut off the debate. You have to go back to 1888. That's the last time a justice was put on the court, yeah, but, where the party in the Senate was opposite from the White House.
You know what I would say, though, Chris, is that I've heard a lot of this today, and I've heard the response being what was done to the judge in the last year, Merrick Garland, constitutes the same concept of a filibuster.
Yeah.
This idea that there was not even a proceeding. They wouldn't even sit down and talk to him. There is something to be said that the numbers of going back and making historical precedent don't work when you just did it last year.
Nowhere in the Constitution does it say you have to do a hearing. And in fact, that's like a fairly new convention. And it's strictly
if you define new as centuries.
Like, yeah, but 1912. But
105, thus century.
It's for the benefit of the senators. It's not constitutionally required. And yeah.
Neither is a State of the Union address.
They took a pass in a presidential year.
The words in February of a presidential year. There was a whole year left. Right. Presidents are not elected to 3-year terms. They're elected to 4-year terms.
It's getting salty in here. I like it. Verona, hold on. Chris Verona, Dave Lundy, let's take a break. Well, cool out, guys. Let's cool out on Touche 720 WGN.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
You go right, you go left, you go left.
It's Touche here on the Download 720 WGN. We have not stopped arguing since
That's what breaks are for. For those on the internet, haven't they been able to watch?
I think it goes to break on the people on Michigan Avenue got to watch.
Oh, that's good.
Well, Dave Lundy, Chris Veronis in studio. Touche every Monday night here. All right. So, you know, obviously we are continuing to talk about the Supreme Court nomination and what's going to happen with the Senate. Are we going to see a filibuster? Are we going to see a nuclear option? Looks like we're heading towards a nuclear option, which sets precedent, a very dangerous precedent for the next Supreme Court justices that might come along. Let's talk also about unmasking. This word is becoming the new narrative. You know, the word narrative is used all the time now. Unmasking is the new word that's being used, and we're hearing it today.
Wait, am I supposed to take off my mask at this point?
Let's talk about Susan Rice unmasking intelligence sources. Is this a scandal? Chris Veronis.
I think it was alleged that Susan Rice was the person. Frankly, I'm of the mind that all of the above should be investigated. This is illegal, okay? I mean, if there's anything that's like plain black and white illegal, it is this.
Which?
The unmasking of...
No, not illegal. No, leaking might be illegal, but unmasking, not illegal. She was the national... If it was Susan Rice, she's the national security
advisor. So that's
part
of this. Right. The leak to the media, that is part of this.
Yes.
Right. And so all of this should be investigated as far as I'm concerned.
Scandal, Dave Lundy?
Look, if somebody leaked, leaks are always a problem. It's been going on since literally the founding of the Republic. There are times when leaking is a big problem. I'm far more concerned about the foreign power that may have conspired to take over our government and elect Donald Trump. Than I am about a leak that Susan Rice may have made of a guy who, it turns out, was a foreign agent undisclosed at the time.
Is that the idea? Is the idea here to put in the connecting the dots that they're saying that they're alleging that Susan Rice was unmasking these to be able to tell people about it?
It's not clear what they're actually alleging at this point. It's only clear that Susan Rice apparently did request certain things to be unmasked, but
which I read in an op-ed today that said that's the job of a national security advisor. I mean, you want to know if someone has the legal authority to be able to ask those questions.
But every day a new story breaks about the Russia connection. And today, the story that broke in the Washington Post late this afternoon was about how Eric Prince, the American mercenary, owner of Blackwater and brother to the Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, apparently
small world.
Had a secret meeting in the Seychelles, a back channel meeting to Vladimir Putin with some Russian emissary with the purpose of opening a back channel to Putin. Now,
for the Trump administration. That's the alleged. Right, for the
Trump administration.
Alleged, right.
Trump administration denies it. And, of course, they never lie. We're going to have to wait and see what the investigation exposes. And but, again, this is why you need to have an investigation.
Let me ask you guys this.
I really want to read this Washington Post article. I mean, it's almost like...
I would
like,
encourage you. It's online.
It's almost like conspiracy theories are in vogue nowadays.
I was going
to
say...
And no political party is immune to them.
But it feels like what we've had here, and I don't know if it's... I think that you could make an argument that this is politics, but it seems like both parties have sort of launched investigations into the other in this way of, like, I don't know if it's like a smoke screen, if it's whatever.
And there's wild allegations flying around, and wild
facts flying around.
Do you know for a fact that meeting happened?
No, I don't know for a fact that meeting happened. However, I do know for a fact that that Flynn was paid by numerous Russian entities, didn't disclose that fact, was providing back-channel information to the Russians, was a paid employee of the Russian propaganda arm, and was a foreign agent for Turkey. That I know. Those are facts, and there's a whole lot of other facts. We know Carter Page was in Moscow. We know that Paul Manafort changed the platform at the behest of Donald Trump to get the language on Russia softened on Ukraine. I mean, these are facts. It's not conspiracy. What we don't know.
It's a Republican Congress that's investigating this.
Yeah, be worried. Be very worried. That's why you need an independent investigation.
Nothing will satisfy you, even with
an independent investigation
together in that press conference.
An independent investigation, a 9/11 style commission outside of politics, would satisfy me, and it would satisfy every Democrat I know. No, I would not be qualified because I'm a partisan.
You are qualified, Dave. Don't say that about yourself.
Thank you. So, meanwhile, speaking of, conspiracies, back here at home.
Yeah, let's wrap up at home.
We have local elections tomorrow.
Bingo.
And there are proxy wars going on all over Illinois, including in my hometown of Wilmette.
Okay, so when you say proxy wars, you mean, so we're talking about the mayor of Aurora, the mayor of Bolingbrook, Board of Education slots and trustees in Wilmette.
And New Trier.
So these... What do you mean proxy war?
Well, so in the case of the stuff I'm familiar with in New Trier, there are a number of PACs that were created to support candidates who are billing themselves as nonpartisan but are actually doing the work of the New Trier Republican Organization and these other organizations. There's a Restoration PAC funded by Richard Uihlein, who's a partner of Dan Proft.
So so PACs are putting money into
local races.
Local races, like yes. for Board of Ed spots.
Yeah, no, they're for mayor's races. There's a big proxy war in Bolingbrook. In Aurora, the governor's folks managed to knock off Linda Chapalavia, who was the leading candidate for mayor until she didn't even make the runoff.
Let me ask
she
you
was
both,
a Madigan
you guys,
person.
You guys have been consultants and analysts for years. What's the proxy part? I mean, what's the advantage for a Bruce Rauner or a Mike Madigan to hold the mayor of Aurora's seat?
You know, I personally think this is about if you take over local governments, you're training candidates who can then take over, state seats. Look, this is not the first time this has been done. Back in the 80s and 90s, the religious right did this all over the country, where they took over local school boards to try to change policy, and then those people went on to be Congress, etc.
Everyone who opposes a Democratic agenda can't or shouldn't.
I didn't say that. I didn't say that. What I said is that these people, it's a well-organized machine. Dan Proft, the Illinois Opportunity Project, does candidate training. These candidates then run for office, and they then try to get them to run for higher office.
Here's
higher
what we'll
office.
Do. We got to roll because we got to.
WilmetteFriends.com is where you could look for information on tomorrow's election in Wilmette.
There you go. Wilmette Friends. All right. So we will definitely see what happens in those races. We can talk about it the next Touche. Chris Varonis, Dave Lundy in studios. Thanks, guys.
See you. The ball is tipped, and there you running for your life, you're a shooting star, and all the years, no one knows just how.
how hard you worked. But now it's
your it's the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. One shining moment for some college kids out in Phoenix tonight. Gonzaga takes on North Carolina. Let's bring in Sam Panionovich before the tip-off. They're about to kick off there in Phoenix. Sam, thanks for joining us, buddy.
I'm glad you played that version and not the Jennifer Hudson one. Thank you so much for doing that. That song makes me swell up, though, I'll tell you what. We're about ready here, JK. It's National Championship Gonzaga, North Carolina. The time on the clock says 1:05, but we should start in about 11 minutes. They're going to do the anthem. They're going to do the starting lineups. But it's a perennial powerhouse, a blue blood in Carolina looking for title number 6. And for Gonzaga, their first appearance here, they're looking for title number 1. So even though Gonzaga is a number 1 seed, it still feels big brother, little brother. Do you follow?
I do. You know, it's interesting, too, because there's been a lot of talk about the physical play. These guys are really two teams that almost go against the idea of college basketball as we know it, just chucking up threes.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got a bunch of big front court guys on North Carolina, Kennedy Meeks and Isaiah Hicks. They're both about 250, 260 pounds a pop. They're only to be outdone by Shemek Karnowski for Gonzaga, who is 7'1", 305 pounds. And that's a lot of pierogies in that body, as I've been saying all week. But they've got good guards, too. Both squads have good guards. Justin Jackson's probably the best player on the floor for North Carolina. But I think Gonzaga also, for the first time, has a couple guards in the backcourt that could play in the pros. So I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be tight. I think, like the two games on Saturday, it should come down to the closing minutes.
Let me ask you this, and then I'll let you roll. You know, I'm fascinated by when I saw the games on Saturday, the amount of people that are there. I mean, when they really do those sort of long shots and you see the entire stadium is packed. I mean, it's more than these kids have ever played. And I know North Carolina's got a lot of high-profile games and Gonzaga. But this is, I mean, do you sense a different sort of tension in the air from these kids having to play in front of this environment?
Oh, tension, absolutely. I mean, there are 77,000 people here on Saturday, which was the second largest attended Final Four ever. And that's a new rule now. You cannot host a Final Four unless you can fit 70,000 people. So that's the way it goes. Yeah, for a basketball game. But I'll tell you what, they get people in here. It's a lot of soft drinks and popcorn and burgers and hot dogs. So I'm pulling for the Zags, though. They're about to play the anthem, so I may go to hell.
All right.
I don't think I can speak anymore.
All right, Sam Panionovich, thanks for joining us, buddy.
You got it.
Look at that. Right when the anthem comes on there in Phoenix, we'll let Sam go. And big game tonight, so we will check in with Sam later in the show. Or if we don't get to him, I think Patty will. We'll definitely get it together. So that's tonight starting any moment. All right. Tonight, my guest at the big table has been involved in politics and political movements here in Chicago and around the country for over 50 years. Whether it was marching against the war in Vietnam or heading up the media for the 1983 campaign for Mayor Harold Washington, or even just recently helping to organize the Women's March on the day after the inauguration, Marilyn Katz has been at the epicenter of Chicago politics. Katz is an activist, writer, and owner of her own public relations firm called MK Communications, Public Strategies in the Public Interest. And Marilyn Katz is my guest tonight at the big table. Marilyn, good to see you.
Great to be here. It's been a while.
I mean, it's interesting because I was reading all the stuff on you, and the stuff that popped up was a lot of media last year celebrating the 50-year mark for the march on Marquette Park with Reverend, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King. Talk about that. I mean, that what an amazing way to start your political career, to be, you know, hand in hand with Martin Luther King.
So I think for me that year, that summer, was what Barack's campaign was to another generation and Trump's election to this group of millennials. So I was a kid in college. I was destined to be married. I was a former Saks Fifth Avenue model. And then there was this thing happening in Chicago. And I was so compelled by what was happening in the South, kids getting beat up, that I decided that instead of being the little good sociologist I was supposed to be, I wanted to make history, not write about it. Started organizing in Uptown, met Dr. King, met Al Raby, watched us get beat up and firecrackers exploded on our feet, and it changed my life. But it not only changed my life, and this is what I tried to say when I wrote about it last year, the friendships forged when I was 18 with icons like Leon Finney and even Al Raby, those folks, as we grew up, came together in 1982, in the end of 82.
Yeah, it was the same people. Huh?
The same people. You know, I came back to Chicago from L.A. I was a big grown-up now, all of 30 years old or something. and those relationships forged, those bonds stayed together. And we're at the center of the Harold Washington campaign that was victorious in 1983.
And I want to get to that campaign because some of the things I read about, you know, and the things that you sort of went about the business of creating a media campaign for the mayor are pretty ingenious. But you know, when we talk about activism, about the idea of marching and being a part of a political movement, you had the opportunity to help out the organization that just did the Women's March here in Grant Park, Millennium Park, just this last, right after the inauguration. How has activism changed? How has it changed from those days from Marquette Park to what you experienced here on January 21st, 2017?
You know, it's really interesting. So many different ways. You know, I've been doing this for a really long time, but the 90s here were very kind of quiet. And then in 2001, we had 9/11, and then 2002, Bush was going to go to war. And I hadn't done anything for a decade. And I got a call and saying, we've got to do something about Bush going to war. And we called a little meeting, and we decided to have a demonstration. Well, nobody had gone on a demonstration like for a decade. So what do you do? I call it the first demonstration through the internet. And in a week and a half, we were able to mobilize 3,000 people, and Chicago became the first city to protest.
Was that hard for you to get back in the game after a decade where you're like, where's the signs? Where are the signs?
It was very funny. I mean, it was really, first of all, in some ways, it was much easier. Again, those folks from 68 were still kicking. They were still the core group. But the idea that you could really reach out to people through technology in a moment's notice was really revolutionary, and that was fun. What was interesting, and also, you know, I'll take you down to the march on Washington and the march in Chicago. The very fact that in 2 months, through social media, you could mobilize a 250,000 people or more was startling. One of the really different things is that what was fringy in 1965, 68 is really not today. So the reality is, except for that one moment at the Democratic Convention in 1968, most demonstrations in Chicago never had more than 1,000 people. Literally, never more than 1,000 people.
Interesting.
And even in August of 68, the only thing that took that from being a 500-person demonstration to a 5,000 or however many we had was the fact that the cops attacked us. If they'd never attacked...
It brought more people to the park.
It brought everybody. Everybody wanted to really get into it, which is another thing. I mean, certainly things in the city in some ways are more brutal. But the treatment of dissent in the 60s by Old Man Daley and by the cops was far more insidious, far more brutal.
And you think about what happened in Marquette Park and sort of the bottles and, like you said, the firecrackers being thrown at your feet. And you think about 1968 and the police and the clashes that happened in the park. Chicago has maybe not the strongest, as you just said. I mean, there's only been pockets of protests that have been over 1,000 people. But there's something about history that defines Chicago as a sort of epicenter for protest. As
I
a
think
place.
That's true.
Why do you think that is? Because it's only been a couple of, like you just said, a handful of times that it's actually come to fruition.
You know, I think it's interesting, even though, one, because we are the Midwest, we are not the coast, and we are not New York intellectual dominated, and you know, both LA and New York are outliers. I mean, there's some truth in what the Trumpites say. I mean, they are really divorced from most of the country. And despite the fact that Chicago is known for its segregation, I would argue that it's the most integrated. It has a center. New York doesn't have a center. New York has 7 boroughs and 7 centers, and you know, Midtown Manhattan is a land unto itself. L.A., you know, I lived in L.A. for a decade, and there was only one spot in the entire city where you could have a demonstration where black people and Latinos and whites would come together. One place, MacArthur Park. Nobody else would go into anyone else's territories. So Chicago has both been, because of its segregation, because of the tension, but also because of the fact that people could, it did have a center, is unique in that way. And also, there's another thing. You know, people talk about misery creating dissent and change. That's not true. I've always found that it's the possibility of something better, the possibility of real change that, really propels people into action. And both in 68, because the headquarters of SDS was here, and we had the first women's movement, and we had Dr. King marching, you really got that sense of possibility. And so that made the 68 convention, you know, that was a very critical year. It was the year of the greatest hope. You know, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King had come out against the war, and then those hopes were shattered 6 months later.
Let's do this. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back. I have so many questions. I mean, obviously, we'll get into the – I want to get into the political campaigns that you've run and been a part of. All, you know, three of the last four mayors you have worked alongside. Marilyn Katz is my guest. She's an activist. She's a writer. Her public relations firm is called MK Communications. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back more with Marilyn. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, Marilyn Katz, longtime activist, writer, public relations specialist, I'd say. She owns her own company, MK Communications. We're talking about her long career in activism and politics and political movements. And really, this, you know, let's talk about the transition you made from political movements and organizing protests to actually getting into politics, to running campaigns or being a part of campaigns. And it kind of, you kind of referenced it already at the beginning. It kind of started with Harold Washington.
It did start with Harold Washington. I had really, it was partly actually started a poker game. I had come back to Chicago to start a women's organization nationally and to run another national left organization. And I had been a filmmaker in L.A. and was working as a director on McDonald's commercials and bored out of my skull. And nobody thought it was funny that they would pay someone $3,000 a day just to put sesame seeds on a bun. But I, you know, if somebody had thought it was funny, it would have been all right. I liked the money. But I was at a poker game, and this guy, Renault Robinson, was hanging around. And it turned out he was going to be the campaign manager for Harold Washington's third attempt at being mayor. And it's a game, which I still play in, by the way. Friendly game of poker, by the way. No illegal gambling. I said to him, you know, why don't you let me do the media for his campaign? Come from L.A. I've been nobody else in the city really knows how to do film and politics, and I do both. So he said, oh, yeah, I'll have you talk to Harold Washington. So I brought in my friend Bill Zimmerman from California, and we made the pitch, and there I was. But interestingly enough, my first meeting with Harold Washington campaign was on New Year's Day, 1983. And I walk into this room at the house of Jackie Grimshaw, who was the head of field.
Yeah.
And there were all my old friends from 1968.
As you said, yeah.
You know, Leon
Relationships,
Finney,
right.
Buzz Palmer, Bob Starks, Tui Garcia. So all of us had grown up. So I had signed on to do the commercials, to do, you know, media by media, make commercials. And about 2 weeks later, one, we had no money at all. You know, nobody was giving to Harold Washington in the beginning of 83. They said, well, you have to do the press. Well, I'd never done press in my life. But I figured if I took the skills that I had making film and took my politics, so we did a storyboard for every day. And we would I would create a 1.5-minute commercial using free press, and it became a real thing, and that was fun.
What was the original? I mean, I'm curious, just in my own mind, about what was the response of the press to Harold Washington in 1983. I mean, when we go back in that story in history, it's like, oh, what a groundswell! Everyone was talking Harold, but was the press on board? Were they taking Harold Washington seriously in 1983?
It was interesting. I mean, it became in the beginning, no, they thought, oh, it was another. It was just the third time and third and out. But by mid-January, there was something happening. There was a different feeling in the air. Jane Byrne was not up, and it became a big, you could see the discontent in the streets, and suddenly it became more exciting. I mean, he had some cachet, and the things that we were doing with the press ginned up more interest. Mm-hmm. And we did go out on radio by the end of January, and suddenly it seemed like there was viability. And because, in fact, this time he also had some white supporters, it really empowered and emboldened the black community, who began to believe. So it began to parlay itself. And by February, we were the ticket.
Here's what
actually,
I remember.
Actually, here's what the ticket. And the night that Jane Byrne, in the first, I mean, Harold was a brilliant orator. He could play with language and drive you nuts. And he did drive Jane Byrne nuts. And the minute on January, whatever the late January debate was, when she tore the telephone out of the wall and threw it at her media advisor, was I knew that we were actually making some headway.
I think about that time, and I think about the marketing materials, and I think about the campaigns. I mean, I think about the media that was done by some of the other candidates, the people that were against Harold Washington. I mean, you know, there, Ira Glass did the great This American Life episode about how it's just overtly racist.
It was overtly racist.
I mean, just for 1980, this wasn't the 50s. This was 1983 in Chicago. At the time, I mean, how do you respond to that as a media?
Well, it was very interesting. It was very interesting. I mean, so, and I'll be very frank with you. When we won the primary, we actually naively expected that most Democrats would line up with us. And then they didn't. And it wasn't just at Fridoliak's. There were social liberals on the North Shore who just could not bring themselves to line up. But in fact, and we were in the general when, as you will remember, Bernie Upton, before It's Too Late, where a lot of the Democrats really were aligning themselves.
I mean, his tagline was before it's too
before
late.
Before it's too late. And actually, there was a wonderful reporter named Michael Zelenziger who was working at the Sun-Times, and a woman named Diane Apt, who was here, happened to be reporters and really captured Edward Doliak saying, any white person who votes for anybody south of Madison is a traitor to the race. So, you know, and we were down. We were down. The weekend before the general election, we were down about 17 points. And Bill Zimmerman, my companion and a wonderful filmmaker, made two commercials that only showed once. And we showed them against the orders of the Finance Committee of the campaign. They were called Shame. One was called Shame, and one was called The Pledge.
Yeah.
And at that time, you could block the entire TV. You could buy all four channels, and we did that once on Saturday, on Sunday night, and blocked the entire...
And that turned it around.
Well,
I mean, that's your thought, right?
That
17 points in a week.
A robust turnout by the black community, great organizing, and that moment of self-doubt that made people not probably vote for Harold Washington, but made some people stay home.
Marilyn Katz is a longtime activist, I would say you ran political campaigns and done media for Harold Washington. That's what we were just talking about in the 1983 campaign. She's also a writer. You can read her stuff. And In These Times, Huffington Post, other places. And also her own PR company, MK Communications. All right, we'll take a break. We'll get tonight's news from Rob. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. Marilyn Katz at the big table. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight at the big table, Marilyn Katz, longtime activist, writer, owner of her own company, MK Communications, does public relations. We were just talking before the break about her time with the Harold Washington campaign, running media, giving us a great history lesson of one of the most surprising, if not biggest, political campaigns in American history. The first African-American mayor in Chicago, right?
And laid the groundwork for two things. And when Harold became mayor, things fundamentally changed in the city in terms of democracy and never went back. So when I came back and when Harold was running, pretty much every decision in the city was made by the Civic Committee of the Commercial Club. And there was going to be a World's Fair, and a very small group of older white men made all decisions in town. And Harold blew that apart. We now have a Democratic committee that views all developments in the city, you know, decision-making. Not only did the city council change, people became involved. First of all, Harold couldn't win anything in Springfield because he had no friends. So then we evolved the public issue campaign. My first campaign, I had no idea what I was doing, was in that spring, the next spring, where we fought to ban leaded gasoline. But there was no way to do it in the old boy way. They couldn't go in the back rooms. So we had to organize around the issue.
Ah, that's fascinating.
And we changed the politics. And then the city council changed. You know, And we ended up with a congressional delegation. Look at this. Jan Schakowsky, who brought freshness dates to cottage cheese. Danny Davis, who was a health activist in the 60s. And radical Bobby Rush, who was a Black Panther. Luis Gutierrez, who was part of the Puerto Rican Socialist Party. We have the most radical.
It's fascinating to think about the delegation, the congressional delegation, all comes from the roots of the Harold Washington administration.
That's exactly right.
After Harold Washington, and this, I mean, the candidate that you guys beat in Mayor Richard M. Daley became mayor of Chicago and lasted longer than his father. You had a relationship with the Daley family in the way that you were somewhat despised by the father, and you worked alongside the son. So talk about that. I mean, because what a contrasting personalities when you think of Harold Washington and Richard M. Daley.
It's really fascinating. And I have to say one thing that I respected greatly about Daley and his embrace of me and of Bill Ayers was that as long as you were willing to work for the city, as long as you were really willing to work on the issues that he was very passionate about and you were passionate about, that was the basis.
He was respectful.
Of the relationship. He was respectful. In fact, he spoke at when BPI, Business and Public and Professionals in the Public Interest, honored Bill Ayers, Daley was there and spoke. I mean, so he's a peculiar man. So they are very different.
Yeah.
And what I always say, I mean, first of all, you know, it was always ironic that Daley and I became close when I was fighting. You know, my firm does more than PR. We do issue-based strategies, et cetera. And I was trying to pass the first law that was called the low-income housing tax credit, which is now the way we produce housing in the country. And I had to convince this guy, Richard Daley, who I defeated a few years ago. And he immediately saw the value of what it was doing, embraced it, and for 6 years, until it became a permanent thing, never let it go. He forced Rostenkowski to take it up, and I had the Senate already locked up. And so he really respected issues. And what was really tremendously ironic is that Harold, who was an intellectual, who could write a speech and could out-speechify me, would really love politics. He loved politics. And Daley, who is known as a Paul, really was a policy nerd. In fact, it was shocking that he had read probably more books. He had read Jane Jacobs. He had read Cisneros. He read everything that I had read on public policy. And he would, you know, and it was always surprising.
You know, it's surprising, I think, for a lot of people to hear that because of his public persona. I think there was a persona that he was a little, he would get up there and he would motor through his speeches, or he may be short with the press, and he sort of took on this sort of everyman approach, but he didn't seem to be well studied.
So it depended on the issue. And I was talking about this with my family the other day. If he knew an issue well, he was brilliant. In fact, I've seen him mesmerize all these college intellectuals that I work with around the country. And if he hadn't fully formulated an issue, he would sound like a Southwest Side guy who had no idea what he... And sometimes, you know, that old saying, you listen to what he means, not what he says, comes true. But he has given, the same time, the year before he quit, he gave the most eloquent speech on community development and the future of cities that I've ever heard anyone give. And I hear lots of people all the time. It was interesting. I mean, I think probably my relationship with Daley and his very selfless and very wise work on the low-income housing tax credit probably was the reason that I did less political candidates and started doing more issue-based work. That it was very clear, both from that experience working nationally, that at some point, unless there was a real reason, I mean, there are reasons to really jump into a fight like I did for Barack, but not for money, but that issues were where it was at.
Now, a lot would say, and a lot of people that have aligned them, that you've aligned yourself with, the same relationships that we talked about that were in the back room of the Harold Washington campaign, the progressive Democrats of Chicago, don't necessarily see that when they talk about Mayor Daley and his legacy. They see him as someone who stifled the progressive movements of Democrats. How do you sort of see it as someone who was part of that team, that legacy, but also had a good relationship and worked well with Mayor Daley?
You know, I think that I think there were obviously people who got smashed by Daley. I mean, I think that Chuy Garcia lost his seat when Victor Reyes and organized against him. And that was true, that he chose his friends and he chose his enemies. On the other hand, I think that people like Helen Schiller or Tony Preckwinkle, who never bent, neither of them bent a bit, you know, stood up, they organized their base, and when they were going to go to battle with Daley, or they didn't always have to battle. You know, they would, you know, Helen would say, you're wrong, and then talk to him. But when she needed to, she would go to war, and she would win.
Marilyn, you know, I listen to these stories, and it's great. I could talk to you all. I mean, it's so great. I love the history of the city and its politics. When you say organize their people, and you talk about Helen Schiller, the 46th Ward alderman, or Tony Preckwinkle when she was an alderman, and she would amass a machine, if you will. Is that still the way politics works? I mean, do you have to do that? I mean, 2017.
Oh, you can. Let's look at the last. I mean, what's amazing about the last mayor's race is that it cost Rahm $33 million to win that race. And what was interesting to me and what everybody should look at was they couldn't defeat Rahm. They didn't, you know, but the Progressive Caucus and those people who were, turned themselves at, won 17 seats in city council, 15 to 17, depends mm-hmm. how you count, in city council. So what it told me is that you probably couldn't win a statewide election yet, but that folks who really dug deep and did their base building and did organizing could win local elections.
Does it seem familiar to you? I mean, when you think of Harold Washington, how he ran sort of as a uniter of progressive Democrats, does 2017 feel familiar?
In some ways, this feels more organized. So that there was a mass movement, it was Harold and the people, but really the folks that got into office were his choices for office. And this is much more grassroots. And it may be, you know, it's a really funny thing. In a lot of bad ways, you know, we're much more siloed than we were before, but there is a depth in organization that has replaced the old machine. The machine does not exist.
It doesn't.
It does not exist, you know, and it doesn't exist in Chicago, and it doesn't exist across the state. There are little mini machines, but they're pretty, I would say probably progressive aldermen had the best of them.
Now, let me ask you this. I mean, and I'll ask you this, then we'll take a quick break, and then we'll wrap up. But do you see, does it mean that the vehicles that have been used by Chicago politicians for years to amass teams and machines and sort of follow a blueprint that really was created and dominated by Mayor Daley, the original Mayor Daley. I mean, is that still a blueprint, a pathway for a politics in a city like Chicago?
You know, I think that the old patronage pathway has been gone dead. Just people forgot that it really was dead. But once you lost the ability to do patronage, you know, Shackman in the 80s really did make a huge change. If you no longer had the ability to give away jobs, your army was going to be diminished. And it's actually, frankly, for a politician, it's hard to know how to move. And let's take some examples. It took Rahm a huge media campaign to win the election.
Right.
And the reassembly of an army, because he doesn't have a patronage army, and it took a lot of the work by the aldermen and some folks who really had deep relationships in communities, whether it be in the north side or south side. Pat Quinn lost, not because the Republicans got more votes, but because the Democrats didn't come out to vote. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting thing because, you know, you now have, let's look at the governor's race. You've got J.B. Pritzker talking about running, multi-billionaire, but he has no roots in the black community. And without the black community, you cannot win the governorship in Illinois. You have Chris Kennedy, has a better name in the black community for those over 50, but those under 50 probably have no real idea, or the vaguest idea.
Right.
I guess there's a new movie on Jackie Kennedy. And then you've got Amaya Pirawar and Daniel Biss. I mean, what is your strategy? I mean, you have to put together.
One of those candidates is going to have to go court the African-American
Well,
community.
They all, I mean, if any of them have any chance of winning, because it was really, like in my ward, there is no more Republican votes for Rahner than there was for the previous Republican, but the Democrats stayed home. They just weren't excited.
Marilyn Katz, my guest tonight at the big table. Let's take a quick break so we can come back and have a couple minutes to talk about how politics have changed. And also, we haven't had a chance to talk about Mayor Emanuel and what's next. Marilyn Katz, my guest tonight at the big table. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Marilyn Katz is my guest in studio. She's at the big table tonight. Longtime activist, writer, public relations specialist, MK Communications. Talking politics and her career. We only got a couple minutes left. I'm fascinated. I mean, 630 just sent in a great point to say we were talking about machine politics. With Madigan still in Springfield, talking about Speaker Madigan, how can you say that the machine isn't as well-oiled as ever?
Well, ask Pat Quinn. I mean, you could argue that that Madigan didn't want him to win, but that is not why Pat Quinn lost. I mean, Madigan nor anybody else could pull out the vote for Quinn. Madigan has tight control in the State House. There's no question about it. And how that control is exercised is not because he controls a lot of mass votes. He controls committee chairs, and he controls what bills ever get out of committee.
Right, and that's different than a machine.
That is very different than a machine. Yeah.
He may be great in his ward. You're not going to beat him in his ward, right?
He controls his ward, but that's about it.
And it's interesting because that gets played out and almost becomes like Chicago machine becomes what Governor Rauner is running against. This idea of it's a national bad word, right?
Right. Rauner's like obsession with Mike Madigan, and actually in this building, the Tribune's obsession, which if they were really going to be obsessed, they should have done it about 6 years ago. I mean, there are a lot of politicians in the state who do things that are questionable, guess what? Defeat them. There is a way. I'm not a big fan of term limits. If you don't like someone's behavior, boot them out. That is the essence. That's the fun of democracy.
Right. Rahm Emanuel, Mayor Emanuel, you've had the chance to work alongside. You got some nice print in the Tribune not too long ago about when they released the emails. You were in there.
I was in there.
Talking about, and there was questions about whether or not you were lobbying outside of lobbying by asking for a meeting. What's your relationship with Mayor Emanuel, and where does he stack up when you talk about working with Harold Washington and Richard M. Daley? I mean, talk about his personality.
It's interesting. I mean, I've known Rahm, met him during the Harold Washington years. And in fact, this is really a little known fact. I met him because he had been trained as a community organizer by the city's best community organizer, Jan Schakowsky, and her husband.
Why
Mark
is that
Creamer.
Story not told? I don't think of Mayor Emanuel
no
at all
idea.
Like a community organizer.
No, yeah. I mean, that's really what he came out of. That whole training school, the Midwest Academy, where he was schooled as being a community organizer. Always a hyper. I'm trying to find a non-swear word for this. Always a bit of a son of a bitch, if you can say that on radio. I'm not sure. But, prickly, but very, very bright. And so, that was where our relationship started. And then I got to know him when he was in the Clinton White House, for better and worse. But, Rahm, too, has always been best at a backroom player. Retail politics has not been the easiest thing. I mean, he went in the White House with Clinton when he was both in the White House, responsible for the relations with Congress. It was not retail politics.
Right.
It was wholesale. It was making the deal with the guy. Rahm gets here, and had some opposition from the beginning, but very competent, but had not been tremendously progressive, seen as a progressive on issues of the war in Iraq. He was not, while Obama came out very quickly at the rally we did in 2002, Rahm was not there, had to be pushed to take an anti-war stand. So he was never going to be the darling of the left. I mean, the darling of the left in 2010 when he ran was Miguel de Valle, or Carol Moseley Braun, and then Gary Chico in the middle, and then Rahm as Obama's favorite, but not necessarily the city's. And Rahm is really different than both Harold and Daley. And one of the things is, Daley is a guy of the neighborhoods. I mean, I would be in a car with Daley or flying back from somewhere, and he would make the car pull over and write down where the pothole was. I mean, he knew.
Wow.
Every damn street in the city. Harold was not that obsessive, but he really had he had the soul. He loved the adulation. He was a people man. He was a flirt. He flirted with men and women, with children, with old people. He danced the polka. Rahm is not that. Rahm is a much more stiff kind of guy, less at ease in crowds, less at ease with people, has an attention span. If you give him a page and a half on an issue, he'll say, "Well, how about a page?" And if you give him the page, He'd really like it. 3 points in a paragraph. But I think, you know, I think politically in another city he'd be considered a social liberal. But I think that, you know, as I've said to him, I think not knowing the city and really spending all those years in Washington has made him a bit of a stranger, and that hurts him more than anybody.
I don't. We're running out of time here, and
and we're having so much fun.
I'm making a. We're going to make a new segment. This is the Big Table Maryland Cats Part One. How's that? So then you have to come back sometime in the next couple of weeks, and we'll do Part Two because there's so many questions I have. I mean, we haven't even gotten into how politics have changed and all that. Maryland Cats, my guest tonight at the Big Table, longtime activist, writer. Also the owner of MK Communications here in town. Marilyn, thanks for being here, and I look forward to having you
back. Thank you. I'll be looking forward to being back.
Marilyn Katz is great. I'd love to have her back because, you know, just the changing nature of politics and how you have to maneuver has changed. And I did all this research on it, and I wouldn't even get to it. I'll just save it. You know, that's why I put it in Google Docs. I just put it to the side. Be ready for Marilyn Katz Part 2. Coming up, train wreck. Dan Bacadal, Eddie Furman in studio tonight. They got two shows at Second City ETC. We'll talk about improvisation, their show, what they're up to. This is a return engagement to Chicago and to the download. So we'll talk with them coming up here. It's the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the Chicago Improv Festival may be over, but that doesn't mean that the high quality improvisation isn't on display this week. Tomorrow and Wednesday night, the duo Ed Furman and Dan Bacadal are back together as Trainwreck. Furman has written and performed for Second City, where he currently is working. He's a big part of the Annoyance Theater, co-writing the hit show Co-Ed Prison Sluts. And Bacadal is on stage at Second City, now lives in L.A., where he can be seen in movies and television, including Veep on HBO, which is coming up this month, where he plays Congressman Roger Furlong, and the CBS sitcom Life in Pieces, which just got picked up for season 3. Dan, Ed, good to see you guys. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us. This is great.
Let me ask, I mean, this is obviously the week after the Improv Festival. What brings you guys back together in town? I mean, obviously you're living in L.A. What is it about bringing Trainwreck back to Second City this week?
I think, you know, is this the fourth or fifth year that we've done this?
This is, I think, the fourth year we've brought it back after our 10-year hiatus.
Yeah, we had a 10-year hiatus, and then one day, I don't even remember who reached out to whom and said, hey, you think you want to do our show again, maybe? Would that be something you'd be interested in? And the other one was like, yeah, and Allison Riley over at the Second City set it up, and we just did one night, and then I went home, and we went, that was fun, we should do it again. Yeah, okay, a year later. Hey, what do you think about doing the show again? I don't know. There's an Arctic blast coming. Perfect. Let's do it then. And that's what we've done every year. It's been like March, April.
You're always around March, April. Yeah.
Okay, so both of you guys. I mean, Trainwreck is, like you said, I think it was 15 years or so that you've been doing the show.
Somewhere around there. What is it?
Because both of you do improv. You work with a lot of different improvisers. What is it that keeps bringing you two back together? What is it about your relationship, your chemistry that makes Trainwreck work?
I think it's the kind of intensity we bring to it, for a better word, because so much improv is, you know, goofy or silly, and which is fine and wonderful itself. But we do one scene, and you know, if you go silly too soon, you're sitting in it, and we just kind of bring a nice intensity to this one show we do.
Yeah, I think for me it was a thing where I was out in Los Angeles. I had spent, when I left Chicago, I was in New York for 2 years on The Daily Show, was working at the UCB, and it's kind of a different approach, but it was great because I had friends out there that were writing on shows, but it wasn't the same as what I did back here. And then went to Los Angeles and had kind of a similar experience where it was like, man, I'm kind of longing for what I used to do in Chicago. And that's why when whichever one of us it was that brought this up, I thought, yeah, this is something we slipped into this show at the beginning with zero rehearsal, just a common respect for the way each other plays and a common knowledge of useless musical trivia, things like that, that just kind of made us kind of fit in a way that we hit the ground running with the show. No rehearsals, nothing, that I thought 10 years is nothing. The first time we did it, I'd gone 32 years without ever having improvised with Ed. So, you know, it was kind of a no-brainer for me. It's a warm, safe place to land.
Does the concept
inside Ed?
When you guys Of course.
Land inside me.
You got it. Here we go.
Here we go. The I mean, the concept, the train wreck, I mean, it's more than just, can we get a suggestion? I mean, you guys are actually doing, like you said, there's one scene and you kind of have to work it out.
Yeah. You know, this came out of about the same time, like, Bassprov and TJ and Dave were first starting. I was seeing that stuff and I'm like, oh, I love this real time one scene, you know, no quick edits, no call, you know, no calling back multiple characters, but just to get the, if you just have an audience hooked and entertain them for 40 minutes in this one location, it's really challenging. It's really rewarding for us and for the audience too. We had several runs when we first did it in Chicago, and right. We had some really good shows.
Yeah.
You know, people kept coming.
I mean, is it what are the challenge of doing that way? Because there's some ways that we think that the consistency of being in one location or playing one character is great. I mean, but there's also the challenge that you can't get out of it if it's going nowhere, right?
Yeah, it's a funny thing. Like on Life in Pieces, I work with Diane Wiest, right? And beyond just dropping a name, I'll say this, that like the woman has amazing experience as an actress. And then you tell her you improvise and she goes, oh, dear. Oh, my goodness. That's so frightening. And then you tell her, well, the show I do is a 45-minute scene. And she goes, oh, well, that doesn't sound so difficult. But you tell someone who does long form improv that you're doing a 45-minute scene and they go, what? What do you do?
Why would you do that?
Yeah, it's kind of a strange thing where it's like, for me, when we started talking about doing this show and Ed was like, I don't want to do a bunch of edits and all that stuff. I don't know. And I thought, oh my gosh, how am I going to do this? How am I going to, one, I think he's faster, funnier, and smarter than I am. So I'm going to be going, here, Ed, how's this? Here, Ed, how's this? And just letting him run. And that's okay. But I thought, how are we possibly going to fill the time? And once you do it a couple times, you go, oh, you realize that you're just doing it all day long anyway.
Yeah, right.
You just change locations. You're just having a conversation. Every now and then we get quiet for a couple of minutes and one of us brushes our teeth and then comes back and goes, hey, do you ever think about, and then another conversation starts.
And by the way, anyone who's seen the show knows that I play the straight man 80%
of
the time.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. Ridiculous.
Ed Furman, Dan Bacadall in studio. The show Trainwreck is on stage tomorrow night and Wednesday night at the Second City ETC here in town. Dan, you know, it's interesting because you have such a pedigree when it comes to improv. You've done so much at Second City, and it's been a part of your career in Hollywood. It's funny because more and more the actors that are coming out and the comic actors, they have training in improv. Whether it be in New York at UCB or L.A. at the Groundlings or other places, it seems like it used to be you could walk into a room and say, my skill is improv. And they'd be like, oh. Now it's a prereq. Like, they don't let people in the door without it. How has that changed your business and how you approach your work?
Well, fortunately for me, I mean, I left Chicago 12 years ago, so it's been that way pretty much my whole professional career. I think what changed it was, you know, we were talking about Scott Adsit earlier. Scott Adsit, Rachel Dratch, Steph Weir, Keegan-Michael Key. I mean, all these people that from our generation, Horatio Sands. Yep. People like that that went out there, and Neil Flynn and all these guys that went out to Los Angeles and to New York and brought this very strong improv, Chicago improv sensibility with them. And all the guys in the writers' rooms, the Brian Stacks, the Kevin Dorsch, I'll forget a thousand of them. There's a thousand of them that went out there, and that was their strength. And people went, oh, great, go. You know, just go, 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 go. I don't need to worry about you. So that by the time I got there, the groundwork had already been laid. It was pretty easy for me. But I've noticed that what happens in a group, I mean, for instance, on Life in Pieces, as opposed to Veep. Veep is a very improv-heavy show with a lot of people with a lot of improv experience. You know, Tim Simons, Matt Walsh, Julie Louis-Dreyfus herself, they're all Chicago people.
Right.
They have improv
experience.
They get
the concept. Yeah, they get the,
And they're not the only ones. Whereas on Life in Pieces, those people don't have improv experience. It's not their background. They're theater actors, and they're film actors, and they're child stars, and they're that kind of stuff. And it's not where they're coming from. So there are times where they go, whoa, how'd you do that? And you go, I just answered the question. That doesn't make it funny. But that's
the thing. Let me tell you about Yes And.
Yeah, exactly. But it's the thing that we learn on stage here in front of drunken Cubs fans is, you know, all you have to do is answer the question. And they go, I can't believe you answered the question. And you go, it's really that easy. It's just that easy. That's my improv class in one sentence. Just answer the question.
Just answer the question with Dan Bacadall.
I like the standing there stammering approach, too.
Yeah.
That Maybe eventually denying the question.
Yeah, and eventually going, that's not a real
question. I'll ask the same question to you, Ed. I mean, working at Second City here in Chicago and so many different, I mean, I don't want to say just kids, but, you know, so many different people come into town now. Even when Dan was on stage,
oh, sure.
I mean, it was a different, the quantity of people who come to Chicago just to study and try to make their way to the stages at Second City is enormous. It's way bigger than when we were, I mean, it's crazy. It's thousands and thousands of people. How does that change? I mean, when people coming in with a college improv experience, with a writing experience, I mean, there's so many more people that have the understanding of what improv is than sort of when you were doing co-ed prison sluts.
Yeah, I think you said it right there. It's like these people are coming in, auditioning and coming to Chicago with experience elsewhere. As opposed to there's no improv in Kansas City. There's nothing here. I got to come to Chicago where it is. We're now like, oh, we had a group in Kansas City. I had two improv groups in college. And so everyone comes here with that background, and it raises the bar so much. People come in knowing, so they take things further. They do things better. They do things quicker.
Do you think it changes? I mean, you think of any art form or any sort of even commerce in a way, but the way that there's so much experience coming to Chicago beforehand, does it change the Chicago product? Does you mentioned New York, LA, Chicago, improv, they all have a different style. Does the product change when you have so many more people coming from all over the country here and bringing their own influence?
I'm sure it does. I don't, truth be told, I don't go out to see a lot of improv.
You're in the building.
I'll do it. I'm in the building. I do see stuff. Yeah, but people have like games they tried with their college groups or whatever, and just bringing new dynamics, and the edits are quicker, the callbacks are more seamless and stuff. They just have, it's like, I guess I equate to like baseball or basketball, something very American, where if you're in India where it's kind of popular, you'll have people just, it's
a different style of shot.
Right. And then now people come because it's so kind of ubiquitous. They come to Chicago, and the Chicago style kind of is taking back from some of the things other people learned that it gave back, you know, 30, 50 years ago.
But I think people make that conscious decision. This is where they have the advantage. When I was in Tallahassee, Florida in college, go Noles, there was an improv group there, but they were just doing short form, and all I knew was Sack Theater from Orlando and the theater that they built in Atlanta, Dad's Garage. That was all the improv I knew. I didn't know anything else. I didn't know Second City was improv or not improv or what. So my knowledge was very limited. Now they have a far greater reach, and people know when they're in Kansas City, no, I want to go to the Chicago style. I want to go for the New York style. I like the Los Angeles style. This is the city I want to be in, and these are the places I want to study. So in that respect, I don't imagine that the training at the Annoyance has changed much in the 30 years.
No, probably
right?
not. No.
Nor has the training at I.O. changed from what it originally was,
right?
Probably very much. Nor has the training at Second City changed very much, probably. So the style probably doesn't change a whole lot either. What changes is now there's a huge run of diversity, which has injected the community with a whole nother energy, which is fantastic because now you're seeing it from a different viewpoint. It's still the same game. It's still the same approach, but it's coming from a different viewpoint, and that opens it up to a whole nother
world. And that's important,
world.
Too. I mean, to keep a scene in Chicago sort of moving and thriving adding and injecting that diversity.
I've always been distantly very proud of Chicago for being forward-thinking in that way without having it pushed upon them as some television shows that are live from New York had to do, where they had to go, oh, what? You're mad at us because we're not diverse? We're holding auditions right now, as opposed to that. Second City was on it ahead of time. They were taking care of it and going, no, you're right. Long before you come to us with it, we're going to diversify. So in that respect, it's changed a little. But I think the approach has stayed the same.
Let me ask you guys this. I mean, both of being in the entertainment industry, I mean, you're seeing in Hollywood or even in just television, a whole different way to approach the medium. And people say the golden age of television because there's so much being produced, whether it be at Netflix, Amazon, the cable channels, wherever.
Yeah.
There's so many different ways to approach television. in how you do seasons, how you shoot it, all this kind of stuff. Are you seeing it, Dan, like from your vantage point, that there, this is a different age? This is something more exciting for an actor, for a writer, for the idea that there might be more opportunities for you? Or is that just sort of the, you know, it's still the same game?
No, I think it's similar to what happened with music. I mean, at first you had rock and roll, which was just straight up rock and roll. You had Chuck Berry, you had Little Richard, you had Elvis Presley. And then you go into, well, now you have punk and you have heavy metal and you have country rock and you have all these things. And then even within them, punk had hardcore punk and punk had the Ramones and punk had the Clash, which are not a punk band. I'll stand and fight anyone
I'm
who wants
with
to.
You.
Thank yeah. you, Ed. And this man's you, right? opinion I agree with. So in that respect, I think that that's what's happening, is they're specifying so much that you can find, this is the band for me, or this is the brand for me, or the style for me, so that people love what Louis does.
Do you notice as an actor, like, more opportunities?
Oh, yeah. There's a ton more opportunities. There's also more competition. But when you start to establish yourself as one of the people that does this particular style, like the show I did on FX, Legit.
Yeah, of course.
Was a very Louis type show. It was in that mold. It's in that Orange is the New Black kind of mold, that side of comedy of like, no, it's comedy because no one's done. Well, people die on Orange is the New Black, but it's a comedy because we said so. But it's a different style. It's not Mary Tyler Moore. It's not even All in the
right,
Family.
Right,
it's different.
Right.
It's raw and it's edgy and it's dirty and it's, you know, it's a different style. And I think the same thing is happening all
across
over
the board.
The place. Yeah.
Well, the show's Trainwreck. It's back in town. It was a long-running show here in Chicago when Dan and Ed were ruling the scene. Still, you're back. You know, you guys are back. Mm-hmm. Dan back. Ed Furman, you're back.
We're not ruling anymore.
No, you're ruling from
ruling
a distance.
Yeah.
Dan back at all. Ed Furman, the show Trainwreck on stage at Second City ETC tomorrow night and Wednesday, 8 o'clock. Is it start?
8 yeah. o'clock. And we are having we're doing our one long show. We're having a second act where we have a lot of special guests.
Yep.
Heavy hitters from the Chicago improv scene will be joining us. For a little more playful mayhem.
There you go. All right. That's what we like to hear.
See if you don't like us. You'll like someone in that second
They got
act,
great
sure.
pizza at that place, I'll tell you what. If you don't like us, eat the pizza.
Eat the pizza.
Love those mozzarella sticks, too. They're probably better.
Guys, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, man.
Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's time for Industry Night, our weekly segment focusing on the food and service industry. From celebrity chefs to mixologists to small restaurant owners to club promoters, the Industry Night covers it all. Tonight, we talk the future of fast food, which to me is fast food without that fast food feeling afterwards. What might be considered fast food in, say, Hong Kong is considered a delicacy in here in the States. Of course, I'm talking about bows. And there are no better bows than the one served up by Lettuce Entertainment's Wow Bao. It started as a one-off concept, a steam-to-order Asian kiosk back in 2003, and since has opened up four more restaurants, including one at O'Hare Airport, not to mention catering, festivals, ballparks, even in the freezer at your grocery store. How does a restaurant that occupied 386 feet in the lobby of the Water Tower turn into a fast food juggernaut for the city of Chicago and beyond? And does Wow Bao's business model represent the future of fast food as we know it? Well, the man in studio tonight to help answer some of those questions, Jeff Alexander. He's the president of Wow Bao. Jeff, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I got to hire you to do all my PR with that opening. That was fantastic.
Well, let's talk about the concept. I mean, before we get into the business part of this, Wow Bao, for people who aren't familiar with it, this is a concept. I mean, these are steamed buns.
Yeah, it's a soft, sweet dough about the size of a tennis ball, and inside are different meats and vegetables. We also do breakfast fillings, and we have dessert flavors as well.
And when I say 386 feet, and the, you know, what we're talking about, the beginnings of Wow Bao really took place right here on Michigan Avenue in the Water Tower place.
Yeah, we opened up in Water Tower in 2003, literally 386 square feet, and it's smaller than most people's bedrooms. And our largest store now is just over 2,200, but we like that 1,000-square-foot size.
What were you trying to accomplish? Because, I mean, the beginning concepts of this is something that, you know, was sort of a foray into the steam-to-order, the fresh sort of bow experience for a market. But talk about what you're trying to accomplish, especially having such a small store.
Sure. Well, we were offered the space at Water Tower Place, and there's not a lot of food that you can do in cooking environments where you need to vent. You need to be able to release the steam and the smell and the grease of the cooking environment. And Water Tower Place wasn't able to do that.
Right.
And they offered us the space. We had an appetizer bao that we used in a previous concept, and we knew with it just being steam, we could go into that space at Water Tower and get the steam out of the building at a very low cost. So we took these bao that at the time in 2003, no one had ever heard of bao. No one knew what bao was. And for the record, we did not create bao.
No,
bao's been around for thousands and thousands of years.
Do you consider is it considered a street food? I mean,
yes.
Talk
about portable street food from Asia that is the traditional is the barbecue pork or bean or whatever it may be. But we took traditional Asian fare and took those flavors
curries,
and put it in
like
the bao.
That.
We took curry.
Right.
We took spicy kung pao, spicy Mongolian beef, teriyaki chicken, and really just made it portable so you could walk with one hand, no knife, no fork, no napkin, no mess, and walk and eat.
You know, so back to the idea of creating something like this. I mean, with a food that is not well known to the Chicago area, to the American audience, what are the challenges of opening up a kiosk in Water Tower, being like, you got your Legos, have a bao. Like, I would think that a lot of people might say, I don't know what this is, maybe I'll skip it.
Right. Well, it's interesting. I think the first year that we did Wow Bao, we might have given away 50,000 bao. Literally, we had to get in people's hands. So we started in 03. I was part of the opening team with it. Then I worked on other projects, and I took it back over in 09. And the year we took it back over, we got involved with Lollapalooza. And we've done, I think, 5 years of Lollapalooza now, or 6 years of Lollapalooza. And the first year, no one knew what they were eating. Everyone came up to them, what is this? How do I eat this? And now everyone comes looking for us at Lollapalooza. So we did a lot of educating the guests what it was, telling people what it was, explaining it to them, and really getting it in their hands. For 2 years, we did this promotion called Secret Word Wednesday, where we put on Facebook a word. And if you came in and said the word, you got a free bao, just because we wanted to expand the brand, teach people what it was.
Right.
And I think we did a lot of education.
Well, I mean, that's a lot of what the second question I had about, you know, Wow Bao was this concept of taking what we know here in the 21st century, the 2.0 fast food, the retail, and being able to apply some of the things like social media and other things to food. And you guys have done that so successfully. When you think about it, you are not a brick and mortar shop. Even though you'll see Wow Bao on State Street or maybe here on Michigan Avenue, Wow Bao is way bigger than where it's at. Talk about the idea early on of trying to convince your business partners and everybody else involved that this is really about being a portable food as opposed to a place of business.
Yeah, I have this vision for Wow Bao. I know that we will be successful when I go to a ballpark one day, and instead of them walking up and down the aisles and throwing peanuts to you and the hot dog vendors, they're throwing bao. Then I'm like, we hit it, we made it. And the goal has always been to teach people what the product is and to get them to recognize who we are. And we did that by doing, we've done the Wall Street Art Fair, Riot Fest, Lollapalooza. We've done so many charity events with different groups where literally every Friday, Saturday night for 3 years, we were somewhere giving away the product, helping the local community, and really being part of our customer base's environment. And it was all about education about what it is. And if you look at bao nowadays, everybody's doing bao. Now, our bao is the traditional closed bao. It's, again, like a slider, but it's fully enclosed. A lot of chefs nowadays are doing the open-faced bun, where they're taking different ingredients and taking what's making them famous for their cuisine and putting it into an open-faced bun as a new way to reach a younger demographic and a less expensive menu item. So we will not take the credit for creating the bao ever, but we'll take some of the credit for getting people to understand that this is a new way of dining.
Well, I mean, this is 2003, even talked about up to 2009, doing a lot of education. Once you get past the education phase as a business owner, as the president of Wow Bao, what's next? I mean, for you, take us back just in the last 5-10 years where it feels like you guys have done more than the traditional fast food, like opening chains all over the place, but instead getting into food trucks, trying to get your product into different non-traditional spaces. Talk about that.
Yeah, so we've got a lot of outside of your traditional company-owned brick-and-mortar stores. We were the second food truck to hit the streets of Chicago. And back in the day when we did, it was 2010, you weren't allowed to cook on food trucks. You know, now they park and people are cooking. We weren't able to do that. And we had a hot box on one of our vans that we would make the food and sell it out of the box. So we were an early adopter to that. We were an early adopter to all things social. And it just sort of became natural for us. I remember when they were building the Freedom Tower in New York, there was an article on the 50th floor of the skeleton of the building, a Subway sandwich shop was there. And I thought, we could be there. We could be in these buildings as they're being created. And I think as an entrepreneur, it's more thinking outside of the box, thinking differently than everyone else does. The advantage that we also had is our first store was 380 square feet. So right. you know you could do it small, and you know the product's portable. And because you're just steaming, all you're doing is heating up the product, it allowed for us to go different ways. And that's when we got involved with the universities. That's when we got involved with two different airports that we're in now. We did two baseball stadiums, two football stadiums, the festivals. We've done a lot of different things that most people – we're in three different hotels across the country where now, they're selling the product now, and steaming.
You know, where your competition – you know, your competition may be for the price point. Talk about, like I said, fast food, like places that are going to do lunch and dinner and do it quick and do it in meal form, $7 to $10, things like that. Where you have an advantage, it seems, is that it is portable in the sense that you can take it in one hand. You don't need to do anything. But also – as you just said, you control the menu item because at the end of the day, it's just heating it up. They're not assembling at these places. This stuff is already coming pre-produced.
Yeah, well, we sort of assemble the rice balls, right? So do you want rice or noodles and which topping do you want? That's the assembly portion of it. But bulk of it's made. Our speed of service, we have the ability to serve 300 people an hour. And if you really break that down, it's literally a person every 12 seconds can go start to finish in our restaurant. Nobody can match that. And that's why we're so successful in airports. That's why we're so liked on college campuses. The portability, the speed of service. The other thing is the flavor profile that we're doing is not what most people are going after. There's not a lot of people in the Asian environment right now doing quick serve, fast casual Asian food. You see a lot of the burgers, you see a lot of the sandwich. Right. Barbecue is becoming really big right now. So we have a niche. And on top of that, that speed that we can offer and our price point really sets us apart.
Jeff Alexander's in studio with me. He's the president of Wild Bao. It's industry night. We're talking about the success and really the changing face of fast food. Because you said it right there. I mean, it's the traditional definition. I mean, this is fast food, and the fact that you get 300 people an hour through the restaurant or you know the kiosk at this point. But I mean, as you think about the future and you expand, you talk about these. College campuses, the ballparks, the festivals. What are the challenges? You know, as your brand continues to get bigger and evolve and bring in more high profile opportunities, what are some of the challenges you have to worry about as the president?
Well, the two biggest challenges is the same that anybody faces in any business. The first is people. It's do you have the right people? Do you have enough people? And the second thing is just your culture and keeping what's important to the concept today important later on. And with both of those, you're going to evolve. If you say this is how we're going to run business, we're going to run the same business mm-hmm. forever for one store through 100, you can't evolve. That doesn't work. You have to recognize what you're willing to make better and help grow for it. So for us, when we get into these opportunities, we're looking for really good partners who we see alignment in their way of thinking, how they treat employees, what's important to them. And the fact that we have this product that can travel so easily and be done so well, we're not teaching someone how to cook a burger to temperature or make sure the chicken's cooked all the way through. Right. Right? The product is there, and you're just reheating it. So it works really
well.
So what
are when you're talking about people, I mean, and I think of the fast food landscape as we know it, I mean, you run into the fact that you're going to have customer service issues in the way that, you know, people are at the front of the cash register and how they act or treat customers is how people are reflective of the brand. What are some of the challenges you think of in that environment, in the fast food environment? Because you're right, you don't have to worry about turning the fries over or cooking the beets and, you know, putting the right amount of ketchup on. The food's already done. So what are some of the issues that come along with being a fast food restaurant?
I think the big one is really it's you have to get buy-in from the employees. The employees have to feel what's important to the owners. It all starts at the top. If it's important, customer service is important to the leader. If sanitation is important to the leader, if safety and employee happiness is important to the leader, it trickles down. And it's important to get people to be part of that page and feel what the mission is. At the same time, you're always going to have issues, right? There's going to be a customer service issue. There's going to be somebody not coming into work. There's going to be something that's going to come up. The way that you treat people in those instances, that's what they're going to remember. And that's what we work very hard on.
You know, it's funny. We had some chefs in here and talking different things about food, and they were talking about their relationship with delivery services. And there's some high-end chefs in Chicago who don't want to do it because they prepare their food a certain way at the right temperature, how they want it. Then it gets given to a driver, and in 45 minutes, it delivers at your door. It's cold, and they go, I hate that restaurant. Do you have the same issues with Wild Bao, where, like, when you put stuff in the grocery store and people could nuke it too much in the microwave, or it's prepared wrong at the ballpark? I mean, do you have to deal with the same kind of issues?
I think everyone has to deal with the issues. And unfortunately, if the delivery service takes too long or there's a problem on the way, it always comes back to the restaurant did something wrong. So if you're in that environment of trying to do delivery, I think you have to look at your menu and what transports, what translates. You know, if you're a burger place, French fries don't travel well, right? I don't know about you, but I've had delivery a number of times, and an hour later the food comes. French fries never work. So you got to put what you want to be reserved or reheated on the menu that's good for it. Our food translates great. Our dishes are all done in microwavable, so you can just throw it back in the microwave and go it. The frozen product we do in the grocery, we teach you on the box how to do it either microwave or stovetop steam. It's education and it's commitment to making it right. If you want to make it right for the guest at home, you're going to do it. If you want to make it right for the guest in the restaurant, it's not going to translate for the guest.
If Wow Wow is going to have a full-service takeover of the United States market, it's probably going to – when it does.
Thank you.
When – it's going to have to get out of the expansion world and get into the franchising world where people can buy franchises of Wow Wow. Are you considering that, or is that the next move for a fast food like Wow Wow?
I wouldn't say that you have to go in the franchising world, because if you have the people, you can – company-owned stores, you could have lots and lots of them. The franchising, what's different for that is franchising allows you to grow at someone else's expense, right? Someone else is paying the capital, someone else is doing the work, and you are there to guide them and help them. So right now, if you go to the website, we are collecting names and information about people for franchising for down the road to have a database ready if and when we decide to franchise. Right now, we're really enjoying the company-owned. We're really enjoying our licensed partners. We have a great relationship going on right now, so we want to go at the right pace for the concept.
Well, Wow Wow, really reinventing fast food. In studio with me tonight, Jeff Alexander. He's the president of Wow Wow. You can there's the brick and mortar stores on State Street. The kiosk is still there, the 386-foot kiosk in the Water Tower lobby. You can find them at ballparks, at airports, also festivals, and of course in the grocery store. Jeff, thanks for being my guest tonight. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Really appreciate the time.
Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, Flesh Panthers, live in Studio 435 tonight. Very excited about that. I love it. I love this. This is one of my favorite times of the week. That 945, 950, where the microphones are all set up. The musicians are coming in. Bob Ferguson's here. They're reworking the space, the Allstate Showcase Studio. Ah! So good. I feel like my life as a wannabe roadie has come to fruition. Don't you feel that way, Pete?
I never wanted to be a roadie.
No.
No.
I wanted to be a roadie, but I wanted to be like a really good roadie. Like he knew what he was doing. Because every time I played roadie in college, where I was like a friend and I went with a friend's band, I didn't know what I was doing. They're like, just don't let it distort. Don't let it feed back. Well, all right.
I like being at shows where, you know, there's a problem with, you know, some equipment, a string is breaking, you know, they need to exchange a guitar, and then you'd have like the guitar tech or somebody kind of runs out on stage, and he tries to do it inconspicuously, like secretly, but he's running out in the middle of the stage during a band performance.
For me, the roadie I would want to be the roadie / bouncer that carries like the poison bassist off stage in the ballot because it's too loaded. You know what I'm talking? You remember that? Like that phenomenon in the 80s when they'd be like every rose has a thorn video. And then they'd be like, and they show like live footage and Bobby Dahl party just too much on stage. And they had to like carry him off, like, you know, almost put him in a full Nelson and take him off stage. And like, I don't understand what that has to do with.
It's rock and roll.
It's rock and roll. Rock and roll. I drank too much. I can't play my bass. And I want to be the guy who's like, hey, you're on Bobby duty. And I got to carry him off. Right? Sober him up.
That's a job.
Or I could be the guy backstage who the parents hired to like make sure there are no drugs. Okay, guys, you know what? I'm going to ask you right now. I'm doing a little quick check. Guys, I can smell it. Maybe that kind of roadie, too. So,
like in similar to in Crashing, where Pete Holmes has to keep anybody from giving Artie drugs of any sort.
I just watched that. I caught up on a bunch of shows last night. I also caught up on Review. which I don't know if you have caught up
on. No, I have not. Andy
Daly? I don't know if you saw the reviews of Review this weekend, but the series is over. One of the best, if not the best, show on television on Comedy Central, Review, starring Andy Daly as Forrest McNeil. it was in episode 3 of season 3, and that's it. Like, it's just
gone?
Over. It's the series finale. They wrapped it up in 3 episodes, season 3. Even the course of the season is, you know, is fair game when it comes to Review. So I love it. So if you get a chance, check that out. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer. Tonight, the garage rock sounds of Flesh Panthers. Flesh Panthers just released new music last month, a 2-track collection called Ride the Blind is out, and they're playing at the Empty Bottle coming up on April 11th. Their 2016 album, Willow's Weep, was considered one of the best of the year by some of the music blogs here in town. In studio tonight, the band Stripped Down. Ryan Zombotron and Frankie Mars Gunner in studio. Did I get it right?
Yeah. No.
always trepidatious when the guests start laughing when I say their name. So that's two of the members of the group, Nick Damlow and Lucas Tashy. Lucas is actually leaving the band, so it's going to be a trio. But congrats and welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. I'm super excited. I'm like super nervous.
You'll be
brilliant.
Fine.
You got a great view over here.
Yeah. Welcome to Michigan Avenue. There you go. So talk about this. I mean, this is something that was announced just pretty much recently that the band, which has been a 4-piece and may continue to be, is losing a member. Talk about that.
Well, I guess like something that we've kind of known about for all year, but it was sort of slow going, figuring it out, and now here we are. Lucas is leaving the band to start a family, and the rest of us are going to forge on ahead and get acquire a new bass player.
How does that work? I mean, talk about your experience. Like, what's your process as a band? I mean, do you guys write together as a band? Is it going to be a different sort of creative experience without Lucas there?
I mean, I think it will be different. He'll definitely be missed.
Yeah, it'll be different. Lucas has been one of the OG Flesh Panthers.
Yeah.
You know, so he's been one of the originals in the band for years. So that aspect, it will definitely be changing things. For songwriting process, like Ryan pretty much and Nick also write songs, presents them, and then we work together on them. Lucas definitely is an important aspect in that creative processing, and he's definitely going to be missed, and it will be a huge change and adjustment to whomever is going to be the next.
As musicians, as you guys forging ahead, how important is chemistry? You know, when you talk, we were just having a conversation with some improvisers in town just about, you know, how they work on stage and the relationships that they forge. For musicians, especially a 4-piece, putting together, how important is it for you to sort of have that?
I mean, I think it's like super
100%
important.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's
like we're all best friends, essentially, you know, like, and it's part of its necessity because, like, you do have to do all this stuff that's really hard. And, or, you know, like when you're on tour, like if you don't like the people that you're with, when you're stuck with them in like, you know, a small van for hours, even if you do like them, it's hard, you know, so.
Yeah. And I think with the chemistry, the like creative flow is like the process is just going to flow so much better. It's going to be more genuine, you know, it's not forced. It's there.
Right.
It's essentially like we spend so much time together. And vulnerable moments, you know, like we're really presenting ourselves and being like, hey, what do you think about this idea? And then we work together to form a whole of that small idea that might be, you know, like we might be scared to present that. So it is a close, intimate relationship. So having chemistry is extraordinarily important. Chemistry, you know, communication, you got to treat it like, it's beyond a friendship.
Yeah. It's beyond a relationship. It's beyond.
It's like all angles. You know,
it's
you have
also like
the business aspect.
Yeah.
You have like the friendship aspect. You have, like coworker. And like
family
member.
Yeah,
personal. Like it's super intimate sometimes. You know, we got to share with each other.
Yeah.
About everything that's going on.
Especially when it comes to songwriting.
I mean, you don't have to. I guess bands don't always do that, but like, I feel like.
Yeah, I think the best
part
ones
of
probably
our band.
Do.
At least yeah. at some yeah. point in their career. Yeah. I'm saying, yeah, with songwriting, you're doing such a personal thing. If you're telling your story, you know, it's better to have people who kind of lived it with you or they understand, you know, and they can put their emotion into it also.
Flesh Panther's in studio, and I want to talk about the music, but before we do that, why don't we take a break and we'll hear some of the music. We'll get a break going and we'll get sound check, and then we will have Flesh Panther's in studio, Stripped Down. Frankie Mars Gunner and Ryan Zumbotron are in studio. Nick is not here, and Lucas is on his way out. So,
yeah.
Yeah, he's, you know what, we stopped him at the door. We're like, you can't come in, Lucas. No, that's not what happened. Flesh Panther's in studio. They're playing at the Empty Bottle coming up on April 11th. We'll take a quick break. We'll be back live, Studio 435. Stay with us. Welcome back to Studio 435 here on The Download, 720 WGN, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue tonight. Tonight, the garage rock sounds of Flesh Panthers. They're in studio. The band Stripped Down, Ryan Zumbotron and Frankie Mars Gunner in studio. Their 2016 album, Willows Weep, considered one of the best of the year. They put out two new songs just in March under the title Ride the Blind. This track we're going to hear right now is from Willows Weep. It's called To the Bone. Take it away, guys.
All right, this one's dedicated to Aretha Franklin. All right. Today, you're the one who's leaving. Yeah, it's so sad. Yeah, stick out your reasons. Oh, today, so sad. I got my brown bag. Think it's gonna stand my game of tote. Pushing up the desert, baby, brown bag, so sad. You know I'll meet you at the Samuel Day. And all I need to do is put a big smile on my stupid face, yeah. And it hurts to the bone, right down to the bone, yeah. Right straight down to the bone, to the bone, my love, to the bone, yeah. Right straight down to the bone. Your green eyed jealousy's your monster, all the bad vibes. Yesterday, so don't you don't agree? I bad vibes. You know, I'll meet you at the same old place, and all I need to do is put a big smile on my stupid face. And it hurts to the bone, my love, to the bone, yeah. Right straight down on the bone, to the bone, my love, to the bone, yeah. Right straight down on the bone. Woo-hoo-hoo. Woo-hoo-hoo.
Hey, all right. All right, come on back to the table. There you go, the sounds. Oh, the Flesh Panthers in studio. Ryan Zumbotron and Frankie Mars Gunner, Stripped Down. Nick's not here. Lucas is not here tonight. The band, the album Willows Weep, out in 2016. The two-track collection called Ride the Blind, out now. You can find it online. They are playing an Empty Bottle on April 11th. So tell us, I mean, I wanted to, before we talked about the music, I want to talk about the, you know, I want to hear it first, which is always good for the audience at home. You know, for you guys, when I say garage rock, what does that mean? I mean, I you know, it's funny because I kind of said it was indie rock when we were kind of talking. You're like, that's not really what it is. So for our listeners at home, when you're, I mean, because it sounds like rock and roll, mm-hmm. but it's just trying to figure out like the category that the kids are putting it in these days.
Garage rock is just, you know, another like umbrella term to describe things, just like alternative or indie or punk or whatever. You know, it. I feel like, you know, it's just a word that people use to lump bands together.
Yeah, right.
You know, and not that I like it or hate it. I just, that's how I see it. You
know? Yeah, and it's the category we continuously are getting. Yeah.
So whatever the reviewers and things put in, they say the garage rock
garage
sounds.
Rock.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it is interesting because a lot of it. I mean, when I hear it, it's got a. I don't think the word is surf. It's not like a surf thing, but it definitely has like an older kind of throwback kind of sound to your music. I hear it on the record, and I also heard it just live right now. Where does that influence come from? I mean, it's sort of like bringing
the 60s?
Back. Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, like, why do you draw from that genre, that time period of music?
That's a really, really good question. I don't know. Maybe like there was something with the planets aligned that for some reason there was just like a lot of good music captured or created during that period, and you know, then technology and the delivery changes a lot, but it seems like in the 60s there was just a lot of really good things coming together. You know,
what draws you to that music? Because when I think about the music of the 60s, you know, I it's definitely informed a generation, but you're a younger guy, like what draws you from that period of time? What inspires you to make the music now?
I think it's like almost authenticity of it, but also you have like a period where like music, you know, certain blues music and like rock music is coming to a more mainstream. So like it's polished a little bit, but at the same time it is raw. There's a lot of soul in it, and you know, it kind of reflects that era, which was tumultuous and kind of shaped our country as we know it now, you know?
For you, I mean, Frank, talk about that. Talk about the idea of playing in this kind of music as a drummer, as someone who's putting, you know, percussion to this. I mean, are you personally a fan of the music that came from the 60s?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I grew up listening to a lot of 50s and 60s, so it's kind of like nostalgic in that way, I guess, but it's also just like been a huge influence in my path throughout like rock and roll and like drumming. It's also just what I listen to always.
Really?
When he said raw, it was definitely the word that like came to my mind instantly. Yeah. Because it is, it's like, it's not oversaturated to a point to where we are today, you know? And, we do have like genuine music, but I think in the 60s, that whole era, not just music, but like the progression in the times were changing, you know?
Yeah, like, but I mean, like I guess for me, I think about you guys, and I know you play a lot of house shows and the bands that you're associated with, and there are a lot of bands that, you know, whether it be the Twin Peaks of Chicago, that have the same kind of vibe. I mean, there's a vibe that there's a throwback almost to music of the 60s, you know, like sort of rock bands that were first sort of coming on the scene. How do you relate to a younger audience that's going to be the fans of your music? I mean, are you counting on them being inspired by the same genre of sort of at this
point? Yeah, I think so. I think there's also like a psychological aspect to that music. It's just like the way that it's recorded, where like very analog. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, when you get into like the 90s, you have this blown out compression of like super guitar bands.
Yeah, right.
And I think, you know, it just got too much for the audience. You know, you can't really listen to that music for a long time, but you can listen to like the Mamas and the Papas or something like that, you know, without like having your ear blown off. And like, you know, the songs make sense, but there is that raw grittiness to them. And there is that tangibility that like you feel like you reach out and touch it and like you feel what they're saying. Whereas, like, I mean, you know, Nirvana is great, but it's like, do you always want to feel like you want to kill yourself or something like that every time you turn on a record, you know?
Yeah, and there's something to the idea that what we've seen in modern music, 90s or even 2000s and now, is a lot of technological advance where you can, I just think even to the way that drum machines have taken over for drummers and even in rock music and things like that. So it is nice to have a throwback. In studio with me, Flesh Panthers, a Chicago band, 2016 album Willows Weep. Also, the two-track collection of Ride the Blind, Ryan Zombotron, and Frankie Mars Gunner in studio. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. What we'll do is we'll get an update with Rob Martyr, and we'll come back. We'll get some more live music from Flesh Panthers here in Studio 435. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live Chicago music Chicago has to offer here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Here tonight, Flesh Panthers, Ryan Zombotron, Frankie Mars Gunner, their 2016 album Willows Weep, considered one of the best of last year, and they've got a new two-track collection out right now, Ride the Blind, and they're playing Empty Bottle coming up on April 11th. They also, Nick Damlow and Lucas Tashi will be in that show as well. But Ryan and Frank, you're here right now, so let's hear another track. Here it is, Let It Die. Take it away, guys.
I just learned how to play harmonica yesterday, so bear with me, folks.
Memories of bubble, mud down the green and blue, darling. And bear if I ever hurt you, I'm sorry I was hurting too. Smell you on my fingers, I can taste you on my breath, darling. Well, the storms you threw together. Oh, baby, that's my one regret. Happy New Year. Sing Old Lang Syne in the rearview mirror. We can watch as we let it. Well, it's kind of foolish. It could be a cliche place, darling. When you're bending back to tulips, that can wipe the fist right off your smile, right off the.
Flesh Panthers in studio 435 tonight. Ryan Zombotron and Frankie Mars Gunner in studio tonight. Nick Damlow, Lucas Tashi not here. The 2016 album Willows Weep, which was considered one of the best of 2016. The two-track collection called Ride the Blind out right now. They're playing Empty Bottle coming up on the 11th. That track was called Let It Die. All right, so back to the table as we continue our conversation with Flesh Panthers, and we'll have one more song with them before they leave tonight. You know, it's interesting because that another one. I mean, how often do you find yourself experimenting with different instruments and things that you may not have picked up that you may not necessarily be professional?
Often,
yeah. I mean, what inspired you to pick up the harmonica this weekend and put that in the song?
Because Nick couldn't be here.
Yeah.
So I was like,
we got to fill in a lot of space.
Something. Yeah.
He's got a huge part in all these songs.
Couldn't just tap my foot through it. You know?
No. Well, you look good. You did a good job with
it. Thank you. I was surprised too yesterday when I picked up. I was like, oh, this might fly. I don't know.
I love it. I love it. For you guys, you know, I mentioned a little bit earlier, and for listeners of Studio 435, you know, I keep asking the bands. I feel like I'm getting somewhere, but you know, I am tremendously interested in the house shows.
Oh yeah.
You know, I don't know a lot about it, and I learn more each time the band comes in to talk about the vast network of houses that are here in Chicago, and the fact that a lot of bands have play the different places. You guys are a part of that.
Yeah,
talk about. I mean, talk about why you do them. Why you play? Why do you play the houses? And what makes it special here in Chicago?
I mean, I think there's definitely not just one reason. There's a huge amount of reasons, and it has to do with like it really works out well for the bands and for the audience, and a lot of times the people who run these houses, if they're good people, they don't get a lot out of it, you know, and they really give everything to the bands and to the audience, art for art's sake, you know. And
I think it just doing like the DIY thing in a house venue basement, it just offers up a more personal like community, you know.
Sure.
I mean, you can have that in venues, and we do have that, but with this, it's just
it's like you're going over to someone else's place.
Yeah, right.
And there's a huge amount of exchanged ideas, and like we talk because like you don't feel like you're out at a bar where you don't know anybody.
Yeah,
or
and you
something.
Have someone opening up their home.
Right.
Is typically
yeah,
what
right,
it is.
Right.
Their home.
And it's cheaper.
You provide the space to where, you know, it's like all are welcome. BYOB for the most
safe space.
Part. Safe space, ideally, you know.
Yeah.
All inclusive, safe space where it's just be who you are, and there isn't like this bar or business that's kind of like hovering over you.
Yeah,
it's
like
just
like,
middleman,
you
know, like
really.
Weird.
Yeah, that's there's something to be said about that.
Providing in that community.
Yeah, that's another thing. I mean, that like I said, I feel like I continue to learn about this movement of house shows through the bands, and that's a point that I hadn't heard before, but it is true. I mean, you go play different clubs, and there's percentages, and there's business, and there's things that you go on stage, and it's not just, that's not the end of it. There's a lot that goes into, you know, what they take from the house and what you need to bring in.
Right.
How do you deal with the marketing aspect of it? Because a lot of time the house shows are, you know, just sort of you show up. Like, how do you as a band
Facebook,
get your people?
Basically.
Is it pretty much just like Facebook? Like,
yeah.
Hey, we're going to be here. This is how we're going to do it.
I think people talk and like, you know,
people talk. You see it on Facebook. I mean, there's no like not many addresses because
yeah, right.
The given, but there
it's
are
like
certain
ask,
spaces
ask punk,
that
you
like
know?
Throughout the years we know where they're at. We are familiar with the name.
But as a band, if you're playing it, how do you let your fans know that you're playing it?
Just like a normal
Facebook
shout
post?
Out. Yeah,
yeah,
saying, hey, we're
going to
be at this
here.
Wink wink kind of thing, or.
You know,
because you can't give the address and things, right?
No, it's like
you
know,
can
like,
maybe like right
the
before
address.
The show happens, but you don't give it out like 2 weeks ahead of time necessarily. And
I think
you
at
know,
this point, it's just like message for address, or you
message.
Know where it's at,
yeah.
Or you
oh, yeah,
like
yeah,
text
say,
someone
message me
and you
personally
figure it out.
Or something
right.
like that.
Right.
I definitely have been like, there's a party, blah blah blah, here we're playing, blah blah blah, show up, you know, and
yeah.
then
that's
it
interesting. I find that you know, there's always been an I guess an informal house circuit. And I've known it from when I was, you know, even my days of being in the music scene and playing Fireside Bowl and things like that.
Yeah.
But this is different. This seems to be more of a connected community based movement as opposed to just Jake's basement.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean? That's how I know it. So yeah. It's interesting to have the different bands.
Yeah. I mean, it's really putting the people who decide that they want to like invite people to their space and have shows, like, they're taking a huge risk, you know, because it is illegal and all that, and then, like, having a bunch of, like, drunk, like, 20-somethings or teenagers,
right.
like, at their place, and, you know, and there's some people who do it really well, and there's some people who don't, and...
Do you find yourself, as you guys get more and more success, and have a more and more of a fan base, that you want to make sure you do the responsible houses, and try to stay away from the ones that are a little bit more disorganized?
I mean,
yeah,
just
for
like,
sure.
just for,
cause you're
like quality control.
It depends
also.
On the space.
Like, you know,
you're
like
at,
we started
you know.
Out doing that, and when we were younger, cause we're not getting any younger, you know,
yeah.
it's also a great opportunity for those bands who can't get into those like 21 up venues. And it's like a great starting point for a lot of bands. And just like,
there's problems at even the best house venues, you know,
and it's true.
And it is a party atmosphere, and like there's beer flying all over the place, and like that's not good for amplifiers and stuff. So we've had so many problems
with
like
a
someone's
more particular,
beer flying
and I think
into
it's,
our amp.
You know,
or
like with experience within the band and level where we're at, but also just like age and like where we want to be.
Right.
Period.
So
granted, we still love
a good, like, and it's a creative experience, but you're right. Like, there is a little bit of climbing up as your career continues. You could play Empty Bottle and move on, and you can sort of, if you still don't leave it behind.
Empty Bottle was mad at us for playing too many house shows. It might be in my head, but I felt like, or like some venues were like, well, if you're just going to do this without us, then like we're not going to book you.
Well, at a certain point, do you have to?
Had that
they give you that attitude? Do you have it a certain
I mean, it
point?
Wasn't like sad, but like I kind of felt it. Yeah.
Do you,
Chicago's such a DIY like city.
Do you have to, as a band, if you're coming up, I'm and thanks for sharing this stuff, because I don't know much about it, I'm just curious about it, but do you have to sort of pledge allegiance to a certain type of venue? Like, does an unnamed venue be like, that's okay, Flesh Planters are going to play here. You know what, guys? If I find out you're playing over here and playing over here, I'm going to be mad.
Oh, no.
I mean, no, I not like so. That. I mean, there are definitely, with any band who's booking a big, like a show at a venue that's either, you know, you have the blackout dates where you can't play. Lots of bands play DIY venues during that time
that's
because they can't play
mad, right,
the venues.
okay,
they
now
do
it
get
comes,
upset
yeah.
with that, you know. But
well,
no, I've never like experienced a venue being like,
yeah, play here.
Like,
no,
because when you play at a venue, you're really just selling beer for them. You know, you're filling the room so that they can sell their drinks or their tickets or whatever. You know,
there's not like no loyalty behind
you know,
it. Like,
right.
Well, I love it.
I mean, like we definitely have our favorite venues and preferences.
Whoever's paying the most cash.
Yeah. We do like those dollar bills.
Ryan Zombotron and Frankie Mars Gunner in studio. They are two of the members of Flesh Panthers. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll get your last song tonight here in Studio 435. Flesh Panthers, stay with us. All right, welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN, Studio 435, every Monday night here on The Download. We're offering the best live music Chicago has to offer in our Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. In studio tonight, Flesh Panthers, the garage rock band here in Chicago, is playing The Empty Bottle coming up on the 11th. Their 2016 album, Willows Weep, is out, and also the new two-track collection, which was just released last month, called Ride the Blind. Ryan Zombotron and Frankie Mars Gunner in studio. Nick Damlin and Lucas Tash is not here. Lucas, this is his last show, right?
Correct.
This will be it. The Empty Bottle Show's Lucas's last ride. All right. Are we ready? This is from the your first record, right? This is untitled.
Second piece of vinyl, first LP.
First LP, and the track is called Elevator Girls. Take it away, guys.
All right. I just want to shout out to Joe and Rhonda Zombotron. If you guys are still listening. Ready? Every got a broken
walk all the way on the way I want to. When I take a green piss, I'm smoking at live weed. Instead of Illinois, getting what I need. I got no business at the factory. I got my GED in the penitentiary, so come on. I kinda wanna be with you. Hello, hello, hello. So come on. I kinda wanna be with you. Hello, hello, hello.
Yeah, Flesh Panthers in studio. That's Ryan Zombotron and Frankie Mars Gunner. The song was called Elevator Girls off their second work, their first LP, Untitled. The Flesh Panthers will be at the Empty Bottle coming up on the 11th of April. They're also you can get their two-track collection called Ride the Blind, and then also their 2016 album, Willow's Weep. Guys, real quick, where are you guys going to be? So after the 11th, I mean, do you have to rethink how you guys get ready for tours and stuff now that
Lucas is
not around?
I think, you know, we're going to try and just figure something out.
Yeah, we're just going
to. You know, it was a period of adjustment, but now that things have kind of solidified, we got a couple people in mind to replace Lucas. And
is the goal to go out on a tour?
Absolutely, yeah. You know.
Oh, yeah. I think we took the amount of time that we needed to figure out stuff, and now we're at the point to just hit the ground running.
Right.
Once we figure out those small details of, you know, the replacement,
right.
We've got some plans cooking up, so it's going to be
all right.
Boom, boom, boom.
I'm sure you'll announce them on the 11th, right? at the Empty Bottle.
I wish we had tour dates set, but, yeah. You know.
We're not quite there yet.
Yeah. You're there, sure.
We're not far off.
I'm just giving you guys a deadline.
We can
That's
see
all.
It, yeah.
No, I like that. I like that. You're pushing us.
Ryan, Mars, the band Flesh Panthers, they're going to be at Empty Bottle on the 11th. Can't thank you enough for performing tonight, talking with us here at Studio 435.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Very much.
All right, that's going to do it tonight for The Download. Patty Vasquez coming up next. A great show as always planned. Taking over here. We'll be back tomorrow. We're back only for maybe a half hour tomorrow. This Blackhawks game is a little bit later. I think it's an 8 o'clock start, so pregame will be at 7:30. So I think we crosstalk with Roe, and then we hand it off to Judd. Really is that's pretty much what it is. And then on we're back on Wednesday, and then Thursday we're on the same thing. It's a little bit earlier. Like it's, I think it's like 7 to 8:30 or something like that, because it's a late game again, that kind of thing.
Yeah, they're in Anaheim.
Yeah, so that's so good. And then it's spring break time. Pete and I are taking off. We'll be off for a week.
Which would be fun, man.
So. Yeah, I know. Patty Vasquez is, I know, right?
Did you clear that with me?
You're taking a spring break?
Yeah.
What is this vacation you speak
of? It's
a
vacation. It's a thing.
Are you going someplace?
We are. We're going to, well, Pete
together?
And I, Pete and I are not going together.
Oh, okay. I thought that would be cute. Mike and I should travel together. I think we might need to do a road trip.
Yeah, yes. It's bonding. It's team building.
Can I say something that I haven't discussed yet? And I know we're right late for news right now. Pete, I love your condo. Is it a condo or an apartment?
It's a house, right?
No, the one you're trying to sell.
It's a condo.
It's gorgeous. The way you guys decorated it, it's just really comfortable. Like, I love the open space with the kitchen into the living room.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
It's weird to look into someone's home, right? Because, like, I used to, if you saw my home, you'd be like, that's how she lives. I mean, it would be sad. And like, a peek into your life, really lovely. You guys did a great job on that place.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
That's awesome.
Isn't it? Yeah. You will never see pictures of my place unless I'm trying to make you feel better. Like, if someone complains to me about how messy their house is, I go, hold on a second. Right. And then I show them pictures and they're like, oh my God.
No, you just make me feel terrible about my life because every time I look at your pictures, you're lifting 400 pounds over your head at some gym going, ah!
You know why? Because I can't get my husband to put away the laundry. That's why I'm throwing weights around. There is laundry in my living room, on my dining room table. It's been there for months.
At least I know you're not totally perfect. Like, you're not.
Oh, not even close. Oh, no. I am twisted in so many other ways. Why I get out of the house and throw weights around.
All right, good to know.
Just so you know.
What's on the show tonight?
We have music. We have food. We have the Pizza Summit coming in. The old style Chicago Pizza Summit. They're bringing us some really great stuff.
Nice.
We have Todd Belcour, who is with the social change. He always laughs because it's like he has so many titles. He's executive director of social justice. I don't know. He's also an adjunct professor at the University of Chicago. He's a friend of the show.
That's
Paul Farvar's going to be here as well. And we also have we have music tonight. We have Donnie Biggins.
All right.
So we're very excited.
Have a great show.